Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, December 17th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, staff writer at the New Republic, co-host of the podcast, The Politics of Everything, Alex Perrine will be joining us. Then, later in the program, film guy Matthew, from his box. What's the name of that thing?
Letterbox?
Letterbox account and his eBay store. Meanwhile, Build Back Bye-Bye Manchin and the Senate parliamentarian overcome a weak Democratic leadership. And it could very well be the beginning of Joe Biden's lame duck presidency.
Jeez.
COVID explodes in the Great Lakes and the Northeast as the nation's eyes turn to Omicron. The CDC now recommends the two mRNA vaccines over the J&J vaccine, particularly if your cell phone service is spotty. The FDA will allow abortion pills to be sent by mail without a doctor's visit, though conservative states have a different idea about that. Kellogg's workers union reached a tentative deal with the odious Kellogg's. The Republican Party is now paying $1.6 million to defend Donald Trump from criminal charges stemming from his business activities before he became president. Because why not? NATO's signals equivocal support for Ukraine. Judge overturns a deal allowing the Sacklers to escape immunity from civil suits over their opioid dealings. And speaking of lawsuits, Dominion's defamation suit against Fox News in a recent ruling shall proceed. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. It is Friday. It is casual Friday. And Emma Vigeland is here to duly note that I am wearing a soft collared shirt.
Yes.
And in fact, it's not a new shirt, but like I generally, you know, stay in the blue color palette, and I have I wore my gray one. Bless you.
I'm not allergic to
God
it.
Bless you. Yep, there you go.
I'm allergic to your fashion sense.
There you go. Well, you're not the only one, I can assure you.
We're kind of matching today. I guess that's more gray than it is beige.
This is gray.
I'm matching Sam more than you are.
Oh, yep. Yes.
There we go. I called Matt. I said, "Which are you going with a two-tone?
It's gray day.
You were going with a two-toned gray on top, white bottom shirt?" And he was like, "Yes." And I said, "Well, then I'll wear my gray shirt, too." And
Bradley's wearing a bright color like an idiot.
Yep. A little after Memorial Day. Of course, though, it is in the 50s outside, which is, pretty typical for mid to late December mm-hmm. in New York.
It's not like just in the 50s. When I left my home
high
this
50s.
Morning, 58.
Yeah.
And like that was, you know, in the morning. So,
yep. Which, of course, it's a little bit late, because if you are in New York, you, and I imagine this is the case other places, we're seeing a massive increase in COVID infections across the country, but particularly in the Northeast and the Great Lakes region, which share the feature of it being colder weather. And people went inside, and I imagine during Thanksgiving there was also a lot of celebrations where people are inside without masks. About a week ago, New York City, or I should say the region of the CDC that New York is in, which is New York, New Jersey, and then Puerto Rico, and the I think like some of the U.S. Virgin Islands. I'm not quite sure why that exists like that, but that mm-hmm. does. That's one of the CDC regions. And Omicron was around 13%. I suspect that we are closer to 40 to 50% of yeah. Omicron infections. And in fact, just in the past week, Emma was out for a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
But her story, I've heard a very similar story from about literally a half dozen people just as I'm dropping Saul off at school
yeah.
from different parents who were with somebody who was infected, and they were with them. The interesting thing about what appears to be happening with Omicron, and this is completely anecdotal, that it incubates quicker. So you hear about it. The people know that they are COVID positive earlier. And I've talked to, like, I've had multiple conversations with people either first or second hand where they were with someone on the second day, the day after they caught it.
Yeah, my friend had dinner with somebody on Friday, caught it, and then I saw her for drinks and
on Saturday, it had not incubated yet, right. But within a day or two later, it incubates. It shows up. They see some symptoms, and in some respects, you know, this is a little bit more helpful in terms of like trying to slow the spread of it. Although it is much more contagious, because instead of you walking around for a week and a half, maybe shedding it,
right?
People find out much quicker. But I think so, you know, hopefully there's an adjustment. Of course, this is happening just as people are going to visit people for Christmas. And I wonder how many plans are changed. I know of like Christmas parties that were canceled this weekend.
I'm glad I went home on Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of Christmas parties that happened.
Are you not going to be going home for?
Nope.
Nope. Yeah.
And so this is what's going on here. Connecticut is, you know, 130% bump week over week. I would imagine New York is going to be somewhere close to that, because it just, you cannot walk around, at least in Brooklyn, and not see long lines out in front of the testing place.
I waited 3 hours outdoors for my test. I got a rapid first day. I waited an hour and a half in a line outdoors. Rapid for the PCR, I think I waited 3 hours outside.
Well, and today there was a line around the block for one of the van testing sites.
My boyfriend got tested. Sorry, just really quick. One of those testing sites, and he was like the last one. They said, "We're cutting you off." He still had to wait for a really long time. And a woman went up, and he said, was begging. She was like, "I'm 20 weeks pregnant and an at-home." And they said yes, but they almost had to cut it off because the line was so long and it was going to take 2 hours regardless. And she was like crying and stuff. I mean, it's awful. It's awful.
And we do not have anywhere near the testing capacity it seemed like we did a year ago
yeah.
at this time. And I don't know that they're going to build it back up, frankly. And then just to make matters worse, not only that, I mean, like, you know, every day I'm getting now notices from both my kids' schools that there are close contact things. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really is exploding. And then, of course, just to add the icing on the cake, if you're a parent and your kid goes to public school, then you know this already. But over the past week, there has been this thing spreading like wildfire on social media where there is, you know, you remember it started with that, challenge. Put ice on your head challenge a couple of years ago or something like that for charity. Now the kids adopted like this whole challenge layout motif, I guess. and there is a call in a threat to your school challenge that has been going on TikTok and social media. And so both my kids' schools, you know, sent letters saying that there's, we don't see any credible threat, but there's, there
like
are threats
COVID
being
threat?
No, no. This is just like one more, just some type of shooting threat or just some general threat, like bomb threat or some other type of threat. And so every parent listening now probably is aware of this. And of course, it's just one more thing to create anxiety with the kids.
Well, it sounds like Jen Psaki, maybe that question about sending tests to every American, maybe it wasn't so stupid.
Wasn't so stupid. Huh? And in fact, there are some, we're starting to see that states are starting to do this on their own at this point with some of their COVID relief money, I think. But with all that said, with COVID exploding all around here, if you turn to the most watched cable news host in the country last night, of course, is he warning people, let's be careful out there heading to Christmas? Or is he, of course, once again poo-pooing the existence of COVID? I give you Tucker Carlson.
It's a piece of advice. If you find yourself living in a place where people are still talking about COVID nonstop 2 years in, it is time to move. Not just because your neighbors have been brainwashed, though obviously they have been, but because your neighbors are boring. At this point, it is simply not an interesting topic for your private life. Yes, COVID has killed a lot of people, so has prostate cancer. Imagine telling people about your prostate every day for the next 2 years. People would know that you are a narcissist. No one would sit next to you at dinner. You would be boorish. And that's exactly what COVID talk sounds to the well-adjusted among us. When we talk about COVID incessantly, we miss everything else. And that's the real point. This is a big and complicated and completely fascinating world. Babies are born, the elderly die, and in between, all kinds of amazing things happen. We succeed, we fail, we scheme, we inspire, we fall in love, we create things that hadn't existed before. We have deep...
You can end it here. I'll just add also, we are incredibly craven for the sake of making money and are so desperate to increase our celebrity that we are willing to make a comparison between 400,000 people dying per year now of COVID. It's actually a little bit higher than that in this country because it didn't start until March of 2022 versus 34,000 people dying a year of prostate cancer. I will also tell you that the average age of someone who dies of prostate cancer in this country is 80. There are at least 130,000 children who are orphans in this country, never mind 5 million around the world, 130,000 in this country who are orphans because of COVID. When you die when you're 80, your kids most likely are well into their 20s or their 30s or their 40s or their 50s or 60s.
Also, I wasn't aware that prostate cancer was a contagious disease that might cause anxiety around people because you don't necessarily know if you're going to be infected by it. This is the Marjorie Taylor Greene thing. She had that tweet that was ragged on like a few weeks ago where she compared cancer to COVID. One is a disease that's infectious. The other one is something that you can't give to other people. At least, you know, very directly.
And I should also say, I mean, like the implications of prostate cancer in many, many people are not nearly as, I mean, aside from the fact that you are 10 times as likely to die from COVID as you would be from prostate cancer, at least on an annual basis over the past 2 years that COVID has been around. But it also... We don't know the implications of long COVID, and we do know the implications of long prostate. Most people, the vast majority of people who have prostate cancer, do not die from prostate cancer. They die with prostate cancer.
I mean, also, I just want to say, why is Tucker Carlson shaming theoretical people or hypothetical people who want to talk about their cancer?
Because, well, right.
I mean, if...
If everybody had prostate cancer, right.
Yeah, if you had a loved one who has prostate cancer, like Tucker sitting at the Christmas table, like, shut the hell up about your cancer. It's so boring. Boring.
Well, and he said, like, that's another a word for a populist to use is you're being boorish. Like, okay, sure, Tucker, thanks.
Yeah, I mean, right.
You're not coming to the dinner party. I'm placing you next to the more boorish.
This person's manners are despicable.
Also, I would recommend that if you are at a dinner party at this time, and presumably everybody's unmasked, you may want to maintain a certain amount of distance. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Alex Perrine. Folks, today's program, sponsored by two fans of the show. I mean, they're not just individual fans, necessarily. The first, of course, Sunset Lake Sabade.
Sabade.
These guys are coming, I think, to the Boston show.
Oh, I'm excited.
I'm excited to meet them, actually. Sunset Lake Sabade. They have infused fudge and coffee. They have great-tasting gummy bears. Almost too great-tasting, frankly. Same with the fudge. You got to be careful. They have tinctures. Tinctures with melatonin. Just tinctures with straight Sabade. Smokables. Pre-rolls. Keef. They have every Sabade product you can imagine. Hand cream. Salve with arnica. And all of it. All of its products are analyzed by third party. You can see the analysis of it, so you know exactly what's in it. They use great agricultural practices. They practice regenerative agriculture, integrated pest management, so no pesticides, organic fertilizer. They have great business practices, $15 minimum wage, mostly employee-owned company. And they have been incredibly generous and active in supporting things like strike worker funds, give directly. We did that promotion with them, over $10,000 given to give directly from them. They've given money to food banks. I mean, on and on and on. So great company, great product. Do yourself a favor. SunsetLakeSabade.com. Left is Best gets you 20% off. Left is Best gets you 20% off. Check it out right now. You will be happy you did. And another fan of the program, longtime listener, guy named Danny, was working in the solar industry, did not like some of the practices he saw in terms of that sometimes it could be a little bit predatory with these companies that are trying to set you up. And so he started a company, MySolarNerd.com, which basically helps homeowners who both may not know what's available in terms of options for them in terms of solar, and also guides them through the process so they're getting the best deal possible and that they have no confusion as to what they're getting. As you may or may not know, it's possible now to retrofit a home with solar panels for no money down. Most homeowners that switch over to solar see significant savings starting in their first year. And this is possible in a large part as a function of the solar investor tax credit, which is going away a year from today, almost a year from today. 26% tax credit, and it'll drop down in a year or so from today to 22%. So now is the time to do this. My Solar Nerd's mission is simple. They help you find the best solar program for your home. Make the transition as easy and smooth and as possible. What they do is they analyze your electricity usage, which is a story now, too, where there's a lot of states that are trying to make all houses go electrical as opposed to like using gas for stoves, et cetera, et cetera. They find the best equipment for your needs. They determine the incentives and financing that you might qualify for. And then they project manage the whole process between you and the installers. They obtain the permits. They do all that stuff. So don't wait. The tax credits are only around now for the next 12 months. You got to get on this. Some markets that are prone to power outages might qualify for off-grid backup solutions as well. MySolarNerd.com will help you with that. MR listeners will get a $200 gift card upon installation of their solar system. So go to MySolarNerd.com, fill out the inquiry form now. Make sure you select Majority Report Listener for how you heard about MySolarNerd.com. And you will receive a $200 gift card upon installation. That's mysolarnerd.com. All right, I want to welcome to the program the proprietor of the AP Substack. That's the Alex Perrine Substack, AP Substack. Also, of course, the co-host of the Politics of Everything, staff writer at the New Republic, Alex Perrine. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sam. Hi, Emma.
Hey, Alex. Bright as the sun today, brightening up our lives.
Oh, yes. That's what I'm here for.
You really focused in on the bright colors today.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess I'm in a wintry mood, and now it's feeling like fall or summer. I don't know. Throwing me off.
Alex, this is our final live show on a Friday for the rest of the year.
Oh, my goodness. There are more live shows, but you just won't be involved in them.
So I won't be involved, but this is also your last Friday show, too.
Oh, it is. Yes, that's true, actually.
So what do you think about that? I got you on that one. This is a little bit of a retrospective for us. I went back and I was looking at like some of what we're going to do for best ofs, and I went back and I looked at a lot of the shows from January of this year, and we have really come in many respects full circle. Let's start with I want to play this clip from Maisie Hirono. She's on with CNN's Manu Raju, and this is in the wake of essentially Joe Biden raising the white flag. Although I think we can argue that this flag has been raised for some time, on the Build Back Better bill, which has now been punted into 2022. But it's one of those punts that have gone super, super high up in the air, and you just don't know if it's coming back down. Mm-hmm. Here is that clip now.
That's where he's at, and this is why if you have a 50-50 split Senate, you can have one person or two people just stop everything, and that is why people in our country should know that a 50-50 Senate sucks and we can't get things done. I'm hopeful that Joe will change his mind and understand that Build Back Better is going to enable women in particular to go back to work because we'll provide support for child care.
Apparently, Manchin now has a problem with the child tax credit because it puts a maximum of $300 per child into the hands of, 70%, 80% of Americans, maybe a little bit more. And, of course, that is what's driving inflation now, because apparently they're all driving more. So it's pushing up the cost of gas. Mm-hmm. Or
he's got a Maserati, Sam.
Or maybe they're all
probably SUV.
But I'm saying all of those parents must be driving more. That's right. Why it's inflating the price of gas. Or they're all taking that extra money and building homes with it or something to that effect. Yeah. I mean, that's what the argument would be, I guess, in terms of whether it's inflation. But is there nothing, and we also have the parliamentarian that got rid of the immigration stuff. We know that they don't have to listen to the parliamentarian. Yeah. And we also know that presumably the president has some ability to make a guy who is so heavily invested in coal be a little bit like nervous about what the president might do.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. We've been talking about this for a long time, and it remains the case that I can't figure out how the Senate negotiates. I can't figure out how the White House involves itself in those negotiations. You know, we hear that as of this month, Biden is calling up Manchin. It's like it's December. Have you guys not been talking on the phone? Like, I mean, not even in the sort of Lyndon Johnsonian arm twisting sense, but just in the like pin this guy down on what he wants, try like if he's not willing to negotiate fruitfully, like make him. I don't really know. It's been months of this, and senators themselves seem as lost as a couple of guys here trying to figure out what's going on in the Senate.
I mean, that's what they That's what it, you know, when I say this is a failure of a leadership of the Democratic Party, that's what it seems to be. And I'm not even talking like, you know, I have obviously ideological problems with the leaders of the Democratic Party. Not the least of which, you know, is that I don't think that really we should be talking about the free market allowing you to trade stocks based on information that you learn. Is, I mean, that just me was just beyond the pale. But Chuck Schumer has known what the dollar number was anyway since June or July. Mm-hmm. Like you say, I mean, Joe Biden, don't you want to get a sense of where this guy is? I mean, at one point, like, couldn't Joe Biden say, hey, you know what? I know you got a lot of money invested in coal, and I got this executive order on my desk that says, like, we're not using coal anymore. it may or may not be legal, but there's certainly a bunch of different things I can do to make it legal, you know, certainly that will inhibit the coal industry. EPA could
fine. Yeah, the EPA, I mean, obviously the Supreme Court would probably get involved, but the EPA, before the Supreme Court got around to it, could probably do a lot of damage to coal.
I mean, one would imagine, and he could just be like, I've got my pen out. And I'm either going to sign the Build Back Better bill or I'm going to sign this executive order. You know, I mean, couldn't he say something like that? Couldn't they come in and get rid of the parliamentarian? Like, at one point, this is a question of how much do you want it? And what I find just absolutely stunning is that they also must realize, and maybe they don't, maybe it's just sheer incompetence, that, like, this is going to hurt them now at the ballot box. Like, had they just started at $1.4 trillion and passed it last June, then I think it would have had a lot less pain than is going to be involved if they even get this thing across the finish line. But because they've done it so poorly, but this is going to hurt all of them, it seems to me.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing as to the question of how much do they want it? Well, they clearly don't want it enough to change anything about how the Senate does its business, including the rules under which it operates, but also the way in which it carries out these long protracted negotiations in which members are, not actually forced to come to the table and actually say what they're willing to pass, right? And, you know, it's obvious now that they're repeating many of the mistakes that were made in the first term of the Obama administration when they had a much larger Senate majority, obviously. But I think that's what I find very odd, is that the Senate is so senators are so self-involved and so full of themselves that they don't actually understand that the way they do business contributes to the unpopularity of their entire party and frankly leads to justified cynicism about the government in general, right? You know, they carry out these long protracted negotiations that make everything less popular, that make the Democratic leaders less popular, that makes individual senators less popular. And then, you know, they kind of just periodically say, we're giving up until next month. And then you can just watch, you know, you probably saw the poll of younger people's support for Biden just kind of slowly falling all year until he's way underwater with them.
Well, could that have anything to do with the fact that Jen Psaki earlier this week at one of their press conferences basically said that starting repayment for student loans is a very high priority for the administration, as opposed to, I don't know, one would imagine a higher priority being canceling at least $10,000 each of student debt, which is, you know, what Biden pledged to do on the campaign trail and is wildly insufficient. But at least that is one of the campaign promises for sure. Like, I see people on, you know, Instagram and like, social media who aren't fully involved in politics railing against this and being, you know, genuinely upset because it actually materially affects them. No, you know, the claim that, oh, this only helps elite rich kids is such bogus and doesn't hit with anybody who's known anyone who's experienced student debt.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's obviously going to hurt even more. I think that the damage, or you know, the slow decline in people under 40's support for Biden is really pretty steady all year, and it kind of has some parts where it accelerates, and I think that will be one of the things that accelerates that decline. But I, you know, to some extent, the only way to explain that after Biden's sort of original compromise $10,000 proposal is, I think within the last few months, within the administration, the right of the administration has been winning internal arguments, right? Like, I think that's kind of what we're seeing. I think in response to falling popularity, because his administration has, especially in the economic team, a lot of fairly progressive voices from the more progressive wing of the party. But, you know, a lot of the more, I think, Clintonian strategists are now winning these arguments about, like, well, why are we declining in popularity? What can we do to turn this around? And I think you're going to see a more generalized right-wing shift from this administration next year.
I mean, why do you think that popular? I mean, obviously, I think the failure to do anything on student debt is part of it. But I think if he was to relieve $10,000 worth of student debt tomorrow, I don't know that you would see a huge rebound from that.
Cohort, maybe, though.
I mean, you might. But I also just sort of feel like part of this is just the sense that they squandered their momentum and that they're just not doing anything. That they tapped the brakes coming out of the COVID relief bill. And instead of just keep moving, they said, well, now it's time for us to bring in Republicans and to do this in a bipartisan fashion. And that was, it seems to me, a massive, massive, massive mistake. And they are just, the leadership is just ossified just from a... Like I say, not even from an ideological perspective, but just from a sort of like a sense of politics perspective. Mm-hmm. I just don't see how they could see this. And you know, I use this example probably a million times too many times, but when we were at Air America, we would get these letters from people saying, there must be a mole in Air America. Why are you doing these stupid, stupid things that you're doing? Like, why are you getting rid of Mark Maron? Why are you getting rid of, like, you know, why, like, Howard Stern leaves radio, and 1 month later, you take your very possibly replacement for that morning slot across the country, you take him off. Like, who would do that? And it was, people were like, you know, there's a mole inside of your company. And I have to say, like, it was a very rational response, because that level of incompetence, which you could witness from the inside, is unimaginable from the outside. It's just like, how could someone be that stupid? And and sometimes when you're inside something and your agenda is, you know, focused on your own, I don't know, whatever dance card brought you to the party, you lose complete sight of it.
Yeah. And this goes to an argument you see sometimes that's like, well, you know, the Democrats, they do this stuff because they want to lose. And maybe there are circumstances in which they would rather lose than have some other event happen, like the left taking over. Maybe there are circumstances in which that's true. But for the most part, these people want to be in the majority. They want to be like, and the reason you can tell, because a bunch of them retire whenever they're threatened with not being in the majority anymore.
Right.
They want that. And the issue is that I think to some extent they've have these folk myths they believe about what you're supposed to do in power. And one of them is bipartisanship, but also this idea that, and you see this from even Barack Obama will say versions of this, that what you can't do is change too much too fast. And but what that leads to is like, or right, bipartisanship is put up against partisan bickering. Like, no one likes partisan bickering. We will be bipartisan instead. We'll be rewarded for that. But people just, what people don't like to see is just like, oh, another day of Congress getting nothing done. Another day of Congress fighting and nothing happening. Well, on the other hand, people like winners, right? And this is to go back to your question of momentum at the beginning of this year. Biden was pretty damn popular when they passed that enormous relief act. When things pass and it seems like there's momentum and it seems like you're getting things done, people, I think, will tend to reward that more than they will saying, well, look, this is so important. We're going to spend a year fighting about it and accomplishing nothing, getting no further on it whatsoever.
And I don't think your average voter actually has access to the information or seeks out the information that gives them the nuance of like 50-50 Senate or parliamentary rules, or, you know, the Republicans wanted to crash the debt ceiling, sink the nation's debt. Like, they don't get that. It's just, there is a myopia, and maybe part of it is because, you know, Joe Biden's been, in government for 50 some odd years, has absolutely no concept of what a person who is outside of government at this point, because everybody he comes in contact with is associated with government on some level. Like, you don't hang out with a senator unless you're really in tune with what's going on in politics. And you don't get to hang out with a senator or a vice president unless you also probably think very, very highly of your assessment of everything because you have a lot of money. And I think he's like living in a bubble. I mean, this is a guy who's like, completely, they're all, I think, just tremendously out of touch with, never mind the experience of people, but just even like the way that people experience government in this case.
What moves people politically? Right. I mean,
I absolutely. And it really is, I just think, stunning. And we so desperately need a leadership that is just start with younger, people who just haven't been sort of sequestered for so long.
With the Hillary Clinton campaign as well, right? I mean, and that's kind of some of the worst fears that we're seeing of how we thought that maybe she might govern. This is a lot of what, you know, is happening in the Biden administration as well.
I can't imagine we would have seen something radically different from the Clinton people, but it does feel like they saw that loss of momentum and decided, oh, it's because we passed all of these bills that were really popular with people. But within the government, they perceived it as being like sort of, you know, just radically left wing, I guess. And here's the other thing that, you know, we're seeing with Manchin now. He is saying that he doesn't like the part of the Build Back Better child tax credit that ostensibly he thinks it's gimmicky because it lasts only till 2025, I guess it is.
Yeah.
He's like, no, it won't run out there. It's going to be a permanent feature. Now, certainly the people who design it that way are hoping that's what happens. Mm-hmm. But we're about to see the expiration of the child tax credit. Yeah. We have seen the expiration of the expanded unemployment insurance. We have seen the expiration of the expanded eligibility for Obamacare and free health care, you know, paid COBRA. We've seen literally billions upon billions of dollars drift away. We've seen the stop on the moratorium of payment of student loan debt. All of these things have gone away. The eviction moratorium went away. Like, all the proof you need in the world that these things are not permanent just because they're incredibly popular is like been laid out in the past 6 weeks, it feels like.
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of people in Washington who live in terror of universal programs that are designed simply because they don't want to set the precedent of giving people things. They don't want to set the precedent that the government can give you things. And that is because it's conventional wisdom in Washington that once you do that, you cannot ever take those things away. And I think a lot of people in politics truly believe like Social Security and Medicare were a mistake because they're so expensive and we can never take them away or cut them. I think that's a widely shared attitude in American politics, among the elite. So we cannot ever follow up on things like that. And that leads to a lot of the terrible ways we design what, social welfare programs we have. But, as you say, I think probably worryingly, DC and Congress learned that they are able to take things away. And that I think that for a lot of reasons, the American people have such low expectations of government that it will make them mad when things are taken away. But I think Washington is making a bet that they can get away with taking these nice things away from people. But then what that leads to is when you have a policy like the child tax credit, which, as you say, its designers are banking on that idea that no Congress will ever let this expire. They're making the same mistake that Democrats made when they said, like, you know, Republicans will always cave at the last minute to raise the debt ceiling. So we don't need to actually have a long-term fix for that. And it's just a bet that like old political realities still hold and that fundamentally, like, you can trust Republicans in general to make rational political decisions down the line.
I wonder if Manchin would go for just a year-long expansion of the child tax credit, because then it doesn't become as sort of edified as part of, I mean, this is the thing, is like, you know, they had trouble reversing Obamacare, but maybe that was a function of like certain elements of the industries being perfectly happy with Obamacare. As long as, you know, we don't begrudge people, you know, health insurance, as long as we get our VIG, essentially. And there's a lot of people getting that cut. But what has to happen amongst the American people that they respond to the idea of, like, you're not going to get that? I mean, we can see the real implications of this money, like child poverty cut at least in half, extreme poverty. I mean, our poverty situation in this country, oddly, has probably never been better than it is mm-hmm. or was, let's say, a month ago for the trailing 6 to 8 months.
Well, if the child tax credit expires, which it seems like it's going to, and people won't get their check on January 15th, 10 million children will fall into poverty again.
I mean, what this is impacting real people. And I guess we're seeing some of this in the form of people basically like quitting their jobs and going and demanding higher pay and more strikes. So there's some at least empowerment that we're seeing amongst, you know, workers. But broadly speaking, like where are we seeing this rather than just, you know, I guess disgust or, you know, annoyance, like where are we seeing it channeled into politics or like, you know, protest or anything?
That's a great question, right? You know, there has been this wave of especially lower paid workers quitting their jobs and changing jobs and seeking higher salaries. And there's been strikes. So to me that suggests that Americans are responding at the level where they can see how their actions have an impact on their lives. And I think electoral politics have become so disconnected from that for a variety of reasons, including the fact that a lot of people now really weirdly have a completely mediated sense of how the economy is going. Right. And I think like to some extent you have this like comfortable middle class that, or precarious, but still materially well, but feeling precarious. And their politics for them is like a kind of like vibes and how they feel about the people in charge. Right. And I think that the ruling class, and with help from the media, has done a really good job disconnecting cause and effect, in the sense of like when these people are elected, then this happened, right? And, you know, Democrats have done themselves no favors by being so reluctant to do the best things in their agenda.
That is, it is amazing to me how much, how easy it has been for the concept of inflation to replace deficit hawkery in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, it was impressive already that, you know, however many Americans at least would tell pollsters, ah, I'm really worried about the federal deficit. You know, for years they would tell like, ah, the deficit, I'm really worried about it. And that's, you know, that's pure ideology filtering down to people. And that's nuts. And now, of course, it's inflation. And the inflation stuff is, I mean, right. That's gas prices we're talking about, right? Like, that's what we're primarily talking about. I think it's
that gas price is higher than this.
I know, but that's what makes me go crazy, because it's like, I have memory of a few years ago. This is the amount gas cost.
Yeah, it was four. We were well into four and up in New York State, at least.
Yeah.
And are you aware that sweatshirts now, hoodies, are costing up to $1,300?
I've seen that. Yeah. The inflation panic is driven mainly by sneakerheads. And
I want to play this clip for you, because the combination of Larry Kudlow, who I associate still with CNBC, although he's at Fox now, and Elon Musk, who you wrote a piece about, and I want to just give you a moment to talk about that, because people should go read this piece and read the AP, your Substack. It's really still enraging that other AP stole your name. But here is Fox's Sandra Smith with former Trump National Economic Council director Larry Kudlow, also former CNBC host. I think he's a Fox Business host now. I'm not sure. Maybe he's doing his radio show. Here's Larry Kudlow heaping praise on Joe Manchin by comparing him to another lunatic.
So we got a twofer here.
Enabler. They have enabled all the federal spending, and they have enabled all the price hikes throughout the economy.
The emergency's over.
The emergency's been over for 6 or 8 or 9 months. And the guy who had this story completely right, the guy who had this right, better than most.
I know where you're going with this.
Joe Manchin. He has been warning about inflation since early last summer. Yeah. And he's the guy saying no more spending because that creates inflation. And he's also said to the Fed, stop your money creation. Yeah. He's had that. The guy's a genius. I mean, he's just doing exactly the right thing. He's almost as smart as Elon Musk.
It's so funny you bring that up.
Who I think should someday run the Federal Reserve Board.
Say it again. Elon Musk,
he is so smart, and he's such a libertarian free enterpriser that he would squash inflation. He would be an activist. He wouldn't pony around in the swamp of Washington, oh my, with all these bureaucrats and 10,000 economists. That, I doubt if Elon Musk has ever talked to an economist, which makes him uniquely qualified to run the Federal Reserve Board.
All right.
I had dealings with him in the White House, and I was totally impressed. And on top of all that, he's saying to the government, to the president, I don't want electric car subsidies. He's the biggest electric car man. I don't want electric gas station subsidies. In fact, I don't want your bill.
He's so
How's
wealthy.
That?
He's willing to say it like it is. All right. You heard it here first. Elon Musk for Federal Reserve Chair, says Larry Kudlow. And you bring up Elon Musk. He's in this spat with Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Right.
All right. Let's get out of this. Now, aside from Larry Kudlow's famous inability to articulate things, because this was after probably 9 a.m. In the day.
Brown time.
I don't know if anyone familiar with Larry Kudlow's history of drug enthusiasm has to be amused by him referring to anyone as an enabler.
It's absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Maybe that's why he connected with like Elon Musk. He's just, yeah.
The Musk subsidies thing is the biggest joke in the world, because it's literally that he got his subsidies. He already got his, spun them into being a valuable company, and does not want competitors.
This is exactly what we were talking about when we did that clip where he said he doesn't want those because he has proprietary electrical plugs for Tesla. And he doesn't want, you know, all of a sudden, this is like, he's DigiBeta and he doesn't want VHS to come out. He doesn't want VHS to come out because if everybody's using VHS, he's going to get shut out and people are going to compete with him.
He's going to electrocute an elephant to prove that you can only trust like Edison and fighting Tesla.
How quickly do you think Larry Kudlow gets off of that set and gets on his Coinbase app and finds out how much is like whatever it is, the Elon Musk Dogecoins are up after that. Well, but talk a little bit about your piece about Elon Musk because you have a really fascinating theory about why Elon Musk's is approaching things as sort of like recklessly as he is with the self-driving cars. And it has to do with sort of like the way that I guess regulation and society responds to facts on the ground in some way.
Yeah, exactly. And so Elon Musk's Tesla, you know, they have cars out there on the road right now that are effectively doing beta tests of their autonomous driving software. There's a couple different kinds of it. There's the kind that's basically just sort of highway assist, like stay in your lane and stuff. But they market something. They market something called full self-driving, which is not that. it's actually shouldn't be labeled that. But they're allowing some of their drivers to play around with these things on city streets. And if you go, you can find videos, usually people, Tesla owners, so therefore Tesla enthusiasts, take these videos of them testing out self-driving in their cities. And it sucks. It like Michael Balaban, a CNN reporter, did a video here in Brooklyn. And every few blocks while driving, he had to seize the wheel from the computer because it was trying to drive into traffic or it was ignoring a red light or it was trying to hit a pedestrian. Like just very basic things that something that is driving a car in a city should be able to handle. So, you know, along with those videos and the existence of this full self-driving beta, there was these stories in the Times the other week about how he would ignore safety suggestions made by regulators and ignore safety suggestions made by his own engineers, Elon Musk would. And they said he was just trying to rush the stuff to market, basically, and before it was ready. And then there was another story a few days later about how now, thanks to a software update, without telling anyone, in a moving Tesla, you can use the touchscreen, which is on your dashboard. You can use it to play video games. And Elon Musk has done interviews where he says things like, well, in the future, it'll be great because everyone will be able to watch movies and do entertainment and play video games while the car drives itself. So he's saying that stuff about an idealized future, but he's allowing it to happen now in reality. And other car manufacturers, first of all, the people who are into autonomous driving, the engineers and the industry, are a lot more realistic now about the timeline for actual full self-driving that you can trust in all situations. They're a lot more realistic that it's years further away than they have been promising for the last few years. But other car manufacturers still have a lot of these features, and a lot of them are great for safety, like automatic braking and things like that. But they're not, as I say, they're not acting the same way. And I think it's because these other manufacturers are real car manufacturers with years of experience dealing with safety regulators in Europe and the United States, and they are used to being regulated heavily to make their vehicles safer. And Musk comes at it from this world of big tech, basically, where the model is to ignore existing regulators, get into the market, establish yourself as, all right, now we are here, now we are operating, and now everyone else will have to shift the way that they do things to accommodate us and our new status quo that we've created.
And that, I think that's the story of like Uber, for instance, right?
Exactly.
It comes in, it completely ignores regulations and essentially forces reality. I mean, this is sort of like what the Bush administration was also talking about, too, right? You guys are in the reality-based community. We make our reality type of situation, which sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. I mean,
yeah. I mean, this is, it's a bet, right? And I think I'm a little appalled that, you know, the federal safety regulators are letting this happen. They are looking into the fact that autonomous driven Ubers have killed, Teslas, I mean, have killed a dozen people already. but, you know, it's a bet, and you can see in some sense, like, it could pay off. Like, I don't know why, you know, New York Department of Transportation is not doing anything to regulate these features. I don't know why the California DMV, which has the authority to regulate these features, I don't know why they're not doing anything to do it. People are just kind of letting it happen.
But tell them what the end game is for, I mean, it's one thing for the regulators to not do anything, but it's another, like, what's the end game? I mean, if you keep killing people, what's the end game?
Yeah, so I drew on the sort of history of cars in the city. A historian named Peter Norton has a book called Fighting Traffic, which is a great history of how the car took over the American city. And what happened was, when the car was introduced, because it was very quickly the most dangerous thing on the road, it was killing thousands and thousands of people. And in killing thousands and thousands of people, it was causing a mass uproar. People were fighting the encroaching of the car on the city, right? And pedestrian deaths were huge scandals. Newspapers would report on them. And they were always treated as the driver's fault. They were not, you know, but the auto industry, with help from friendly voices in the press and with help from friendly people in the government, organized and invented something called jaywalking, and used, you know, the power of the police and the power of the media and all these other things to sort of say, oh, no. I know that you have always treated the road as someplace you can just walk wherever you like, but it turns out you were wrong. Where pedestrians belong is here at these corners, where we have put signals here and said, this is the only time you're allowed in the road. That worked, obviously. And the autonomous driving version of that is saying, well, look, if his cars his cars are going around cities, running into buses, running into houses, and killing children, killing pedestrians, if they're doing that, people will be outraged. They will stop Tesla. They will say, don't do this. But what if you knew that general history of the automobile? Then all of a sudden what you're doing is you say, well, how do we reorient the streets to make them safe for these cars? And you can see, you know, a couple years ago, there were non-Elon Musk autonomous driving engineers and people who are in the industry would be quoted in news stories offhandedly suggesting something like, maybe we could put gates at the crosswalk. So we've moved from, like, moving the pedestrian to the crosswalk to, like, okay, now we're just going to wall them off. And I think to build the kind of future Musk wants, which is basically like, the streets belong to people being chauffeured by robots. He's going to want to have to build that kind of thing, right? Like, that's kind of what his dream is.
It seems to me like a long shot bet, because that's going to.
Well, it's a long shot, right? But, like, he also does genuinely think he's going to have factories on Mars, like, within his lifetime.
Right.
I think that's a deeply silly thing to think is close to happening. But when you have lost as rarely as he has, and you have more money than God, you can convince yourself of a lot of things.
And again, that is like just another example of, like, sometimes we, as just sort of frankly normal people, can underestimate the delusion and the myopia of people who are overlords in this world. Mm-hmm.
And also, I just wanted to, like, you brought up the Uber point, Sam. What Musk and a lot of these tech guys rely on is the fact that while tech is now spreading into industries like automobiles or with Uber rideshare, they identify as a tech company, so they don't have to answer to a lot of, we cover this a bit, the regulations and the oversight.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And that's going to be something we see a lot more happen a lot more frequently as tech begins to dominate, right? they are skirting around traditional modes of regulation because they also have an in and they look sexy as the new tech company. And the it's like a new frontier. So it allows for it's a rife environment for exploitation.
Yeah, and that's right, because what these companies are not in the they're not in the boring old business that they're disrupting, even though they are, right? Like Uber was a taxi company, but it's a tech startup, and Tesla's not boring old GM. It's like an incredibly cool, sexy startup, and that helps give them a sort of sheen that I think, in a PR sense and a political sense, shields them from scrutiny that they would otherwise get, right? Like there are a lot of normal people who think Elon Musk is a cool hero and that his car company is doing cool things. And that's sort of the extent of their engagement with it. And then, you know, that kind of stuff seduces a lot of elected Democrats as well.
Folks can read that piece along with a bunch of other great writing at a place called the AP Substack. Still waiting for your lawsuit against the...
Yeah, I'm talking to my lawyers. We'll we're drafting something.
But this is the high quality AP that people refer to, and of course, they can check out your writing at the New Republic, Alex, and of course your podcast, The Politics of Everything. Have a great New Year and great Christmas and Equinox. Have we missed that?
All those things.
Yeah.
Safe and happy holidays to you.
Yeah, a happy new year.
I see those I see those wrapping paper.
Yeah, you got the wrapping paper for all this stuff.
They are like those rolls are long and inconvenient and not easy to store. I don't know where to put them in my
Yeah, I don't know what we're going to do with it when we're done with all my kids' crap.
The same matching luggage that you have back there.
Oh, really?
I've never gotten a Fresh Direct in my life. I have like five.
You have like a million of those bags, right? They just every New Yorker, everyone in New York has like 10 of those now.
Right, right, exactly.
Alex Breen, thanks so much, man. We'll see you in 2022.
All right, see you later.
Now, folks,
I will run to the restroom really quick.
As Emma takes a moment to refresh, I will remind you before we have Matthew Film Guy in, that in exactly 1 month from yesterday, January 16th, we will be live in Boston with the Big Live Show of the Majority Report in Boston 2022. The first live show we have done in years, and it will be the first of 2022. Maybe there'll be more. Maybe there won't. We'll see how it goes. But you could see how it goes by going to Majority Live or MajorityReportLive.com. Either one. Purchase your tickets before they're all gone. We still have some left. But they're going quick. Got to be quick to get these tickets. And we're going to have fun. We've got all sorts of crazy antics prepared. Right? Yeah.
Antics.
Oh, yeah. There's going to be antics. And theatrics. Speaking of theater, sometimes you go and watch a film in a theater. And thus, it is a great segue into the appearance of the person who inspired this theme song.
Matthew, the film guy, is choosing us.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the final Friday, live Friday show, because of course next Friday is Christmas Eve day. We will have no show on that day. And thus, we bring on probably our, well, no. I was going to say you were one of our earliest, like, regular Friday guests, but that's not true. Chris Rosen was.
Yeah, but I guess the longevity goes to me.
Yeah, when was that? When did I find out that the film, this segment, I should just tell people, started at a time when my kids were young. I never got the opportunity to see a movie. Now, of course, there's COVID. You never get a chance to go out and see a movie, or rarely anyways. In my instance, never. And so I wanted to stream. And this is when the streaming technology was actually like new. And it was like, what am I going to do? This stream a movie? What does that mean? Stream a movie? And I would bring on someone who I thought was a movie review critic.
Right. I'm back. Hello, Matthew.
Chris Rosen, who was a board op at the time at Air America back in the day. And I brought him on. It took like a year or more till I found out that he was not actually a movie critic. He was just an entertainment reporter. You know, I don't mean just, but I mean, he was an entertainment reporter. And so, I bounced him and brought on a true cinephile. When was that?
I want to say 2012, maybe 2011, even maybe 2012.
Holy shit. We've been, cause it feels like you're just starting to now. It's starting to feel comfortable talking to you. Let me ask you about those glasses. Are those new?
Yes, they're new.
You know what? I like those.
And
they are a little bit reminiscent of Bob Evans, the famed producer.
Yeah, I a little thicker, and I think I'd be right in there. But sure, yeah, I'll take that. Bob Evans, the famous new Hollywood enabler, if you will.
Yep, I knew you would. I knew you would. And I raise that because, do you want to talk about the new film you're working on?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm just getting started on a new independent feature film. It's called Abandoned, and it is starring Emma Roberts, John Gallagher Jr., and Michael Shannon has a small part in it. So it's been a lot of fun. I'm still in the early days of it. So things are hectic, as it always is on the independent film scene. But yeah, what can I say? It's been a great experience so far.
So wait, have they shot it? Are you editing it?
I'm about 5 weeks into editing.
Holy cow.
Yeah. So listen, it's definitely doing you a huge favor to take a break here and do this. So let's try to keep it going.
All right. We'll keep moving. What happened last time we spoke, though? Weren't you like up for some comedy thing? And
I was up for a few things. I was up for this at the time. I think we had been in discussions, and this is what landed.
And did they bring up like your regular appearance on the Majority Report? Was that a big selling point for them?
I'm not sure if it was or not. They didn't mention it to me if it was, but it was more so
probably a negotiation technique,
right? Leaving it in their hip pocket.
They don't want to split like we've seen you on the Majority Report, because then all of a sudden you're like, yes, oh, okay, well then you'll understand why I'm asking for about 25% bump.
Exactly. My blinding celebrity usually just really bigfoots people when they start to negotiate. So I try to keep it on the down low. Yeah, but that's, it was more the, my previous work editing Black Bear. I got this through my agent. So finally those are starting to pay off. And yeah, it's been great. What can I say?
Are there new shelving? I mean, there's something about like the backdrop, don't you think, that looks a little bit more sort of
exactly
like upgraded?
The same. It looks exactly the same. Right?
Maybe it's exactly the same. I mean, maybe I've obtained a few more books. I don't know how precise your vision is that you can see like three or four book lengths that have grown since the last time I saw you. But I put a lot of care and attention into making sure this looks like a background, but it's actually also my bookshelves.
Sam has those laser eyes. He's able to.
That's true. I've seen that.
Yeah.
And so, all right. So give us a sense for those of us who are not professional editors of what's the process? You're 5 weeks into it. So what does that mean? Like the shooting has taken place and then what's the first thing that you do? I mean, you log all the material, right? You watch all the material.
Yes. That's basically, I'm just about a week past doing that. So for the first 3 to 4 weeks, all I'm doing is watching every single frame of the footage, getting it into my DNA, my personal process. And again, I've worked with other people who maybe do it a little bit differently, but I go through and make detailed notes on every line and every take and, you know, camera shot, this is working, this is not working in the program. So I can kind of easily reference everything once the real work starts to start. And that's the labor intensive detailed process. And now I'm actually putting it together.
What was this shot on? And I ask because this
it was shot on DigiBeta.
Okay. So it's shot on Digi. No, it wasn't. What was it?
It was shot on, 4K. Yes.
Fucking bastard.
Yes, but it was shot on, you know, digital video, state-of-the-art digital video.
Oh, so what's digital video?
Yeah, but not DigiBeta. That was your personal innovation.
Well, they had no other, that was it. That was at the forefront. That was the vanguard at the time.
That's right.
Point being, they didn't shoot it on film. So in other words, will you just explain to us the shooting ratio and what the implications are for someone who's an editor?
Shooting ratio refers to how many hours of film you shoot versus how many hours the actual film winds up running. So, you know, I think I did kind of look at it at one point. It could only be a 10-to-1 shooting ratio for this movie. They shot 19 hours to make an hour and 45-minute movie, although I didn't completely add it all up, but I think that's about close.
But if this film was shot 30 years ago on 16mm or 35mm...
Oh, yeah. No, there's plenty of takes, Sam, where it's just rolling, reset, rolling. They don't cut. They just roll. The camera moves back to one.
What shooting ratio to be back then?
Half as much.
5-to-1 would have been a high shooting ratio for a 16mm film or a 35mm low-budget film, right?
Yeah. I mean, and this is not even the highest shooting ratio there is, because on a low-budget movie, you know, mid-budget movie like this, it's still short days and trying to get everything done quickly, so they're not spending all day on one scene, even in this case. But yeah, with digital video, no need to cut, because then you got to bring the crew, you know, the slate in again and, bring all this stuff and just set everybody back to one and start again. So that's actually what I did on the first week of actually editing, is just take out all the reset moments and you whittle it down, make it more manageable.
And also, we should say that there's no, you don't have to reload the camera in the same way. So like it used to be like a 16mm mag of film would last like what, 12 minutes. So yeah. Every 12 minutes of shooting, you would have to reload the camera, which would take, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5 minutes or something.
Absolutely.
Shooting days. You know, if you've got to do that every 12 minutes, your shooting days are longer in terms of like what you can actually, like the camera's rolling, even if it's not just a reset. I mean, you can take more takes. And so that is a, but of course your technology is also really different too, because you're not, you know, in front of like some type of like reel to reel, cutting thing. It's all computerized.
And Grandpa Cedar going back to the well, the flatbed editing process. Yeah. No, I had some of that in school. So I was on the edge of that, that technology. No, I'll go down memory lane with you, Sam. This is fun.
Okay. It's not just,
I was like the last, class, I think, mid 90s to really even shoot on film. Once DV came out. What's that, Emma?
Pummeled today.
Yeah.
About you. I mean, you are. Do you have some like passive aggressive situation that, you know, you want to tell Sam something you've been thinking?
Yeah, Not at all. I just wanted to provide context to the conversation that Sam is driving us into. That's all. Yeah.
I mean, I
follows up on Black Bear and all of a sudden he's a little bit cocky. It seems like.
I say that as an expert in passive aggression towards Sam.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sam. No, not at all. I'd love to continue talking about obsolete technology and how it compares to the modern filmmaking process.
I got news for you, Chief. When she does it, she's not in the brittle glass house that you're in.
That's right. I cop to it. I know everything you're talking about.
Grandpa, you know. I got news for you, buddy.
Uncle Cedar.
Yeah. I won't.
I think of this all the time watching the show. I'm right in between, like you and Emma and Matt. Like you're 10 years older than me. They're 10 years younger than me. So like, I kind of have a foot in both worlds. Like I get when you say they took my thumbs, they took my thumbs. I get that. All right. So I can appreciate certain things that are a little
That's
bit
the
lost.
Pope of Greenwich Village. That's the what's his face? Eric Roberts in the Pope of Greenwich.
Eric Roberts. And actually Emma Roberts is his daughter, who's in, by the way, in Abandoned, the star of this film.
I know she's Julia Roberts' niece.
Niece, yeah. Eric and Julia are brother and sister, yeah. Eric Roberts, great actor, character actor, weird guy.
Star 80, a lot of weird stuff.
Granite Village, you know. Yep. And Emma's great, too. She's really actually good. You know, I didn't actually know her very well. She's sort of famous to a younger set of people. Emma, I'm sure you've heard of her. You share a name with her, so you have to.
Yes. And she had her own Nickelodeon show, Unfabulous, which was
That's big. What I understood. She was a child actress. And, you know, she's got a reputation of being in, like, comedy and horror and stuff like that. But this is sort of a departure for her. It's a little bit more serious. It's more of a horror drama. And she's really actually doing a great job. So this is another thing. So, similar to what I did with Black Bear. I think that's what they thought they were getting from me, is, like, you know, take a comedic or an actress who had done other stuff and, you know, showcase her in her acting chops here. And
well, she did Scream Queens, right? I mean, I hear that's like that's kind of like a cult like classic. Yes. A little bit, but that's
Mary loves that. I've been watching some of it vicariously through Mary, watching it, and it's campy. It's a high comedy kind of drama. She's great in that too, but it's a different flavor.
Yeah,
talent. But anyway,
so Matthew, getting back to the process.
My thumbs. Okay. Go on.
So you've gone through and you've cataloged and logged all of the footage that you have.
Yeah.
So, like, what is if you've taken detailed notes, this is a good shot or the performance was strong here. And I imagine
if you want to get really inside baseball, on Adobe Premiere, you can do a marker. And I think in Avid 2 and all of them, you put a marker literally on the cut, on the actual clip. And you put right at this time code, this line, great read, great performance, this moment. You know, and then you can jump between each one and instantly compare.
And I would imagine you can search for the terms that you put.
I set up my dashboard with the marker tool right in the middle so I can do a keyword search. You know, this line, it's so great.
So do you, and you have all the footage now, right? You're not editing this as you were going.
No.
Okay. So you have all the footage. Is the first thing you do, like, you just put, like, okay, I'm not going to worry. I'm going to take all the cuts from every scene that I say are the best. I'm just going to string them together. Or do you start to do, like, editorial on the story first? Or, like, what's the first step? Once you've logged it all, what's the first step?
I break it apart by scene because, you know, they shoot out of order. So it's all different by day. So I organize it that way. Then actually, you know, the camera writes out every clip as, like, A000, all this camera data. So I rename everything so I know this is scene 23, Apple take one, scene, that.
But clerical.
And then what that gives me is the story in order in chunks. But each scene, I'm just going through and building the scene. You know, my first pass is
Scenes in the order in the script, or do you say, like, I'm going to tackle this scene first because this scene is pivotal to the second act and I want to see where this goes before I go backwards with that? Or do you go sequentially and build the scenes, or do you go just like, I'm just going to sequence the whole movie together and then focus on a scene by scene basis?
A little bit of both, Sam. That's actually a really good question because
they're all great questions, but
I know that one is the first good question. And so I will answer it. No, the other ones were okay, but it led to this one. So they were worth it. I actually start with one or two scenes that I think might be a problem. Like, oh, I'm watching this and I'm not seeing, oh, where's this? Maybe reaction or, you know, what, not to get in too much detail, but like maybe they didn't get this and how's this going to work? So if I think it's like a problem child, I might try to tackle that first. But actually now I went back to almost the beginning and, you know, basically am doing it in order. It's kind of fun to watch the movie because, you know, I come from the world of Walter Murch where he doesn't really even want to read the script. He just wants to look at the footage and see what do we have here? What kind of movie, the best movie we can make out of this footage without getting hung up on, oh, we tried this. It didn't work out. It took us 2 days to do this. But, you know, so I'm just really the first pass through is getting me the story.
I want you to just expand on that, because I don't think under people who maybe necessarily appreciate what you're saying there is, like, if you read the script and then look at the footage, you're going to be talking about like, shoot, they didn't get this coverage, or shoot, this whole idea of this twist where it was going to be a reveal and we had a sense that this character was this way or that way, that's not executed here. And so you immediately start to approach the material from its deficit, rather than starting from like, you know, what you're creating. But people do that different ways, right? Like, I mean, I know that like as a director, I would approach it as like, shoot, what did I miss?
Right. Yeah. And look, this is my first assembly. Later I'll get together with the director and then we'll start to kind of compare notes, and he'll say, no, this is really important to me that we try to get this to work. And I'll say, okay, I'll figure out a way to do it, or, you know, it's not there, whatever. But from the start, I'm just trying to make what I think is available here. Once in a while, I will look at the script and go like, what is this guy doing? And then I'll read the script, like, oh, okay. And that'll kind of help me know what I'm looking at and then to build it. But for the most part, you know, I am building the scene like from A to B to C to D. And if I think something, you know, needs a little bit more time, I'll play it out more. And you know, it's just, that's the fun of it really, is you're sculpting, you're building a world. And all that first stuff we talked about is like setting up the palette, you know, laying out your colors and seeing where everything is. And then you start to paint.
So let's talk about Black Bear, just a little bit in terms of, because obviously you don't know, how it's going to go with this. You haven't sat down with the director with like your first cut, essentially. How long will your first cut be? Obviously it's a function of like, you don't know. It may be 2 hours, it may be two and a half hours, right?
Yeah, well, that's one aspect of a first cut. It's like, I just put in every idea, like, just try this. Here's what we have here. Let's just put everything that they tried to do, or it looks like could be possible. Then you look at it and you go, oh shit, it's 2.5 hours. That's what happened with Black Bear. Our first cut was 2 hours and 45 minutes. We cut almost an hour out of it. So, you know, but the first pass is, don't be too judgmental at first, just to see what it is. And sometimes when you're putting something together within a scene, it looks great. Then you put it against the rest of the movie and you're like, oh, that's redundant, or it's not necessary, or it's taking too long, or whatever it is. And false, you take it out. So first pass, get, you know, heavy, thick.
So what do you do? You've got your 2.5 hour cut. The director comes in and they take a look at it and they say, oh, no, that scene right there, you know, the lead character has to express the futility of this adventure they're on, or blah, 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 whatever it is. And you're thinking, oh, Jesus Christ, that's not here, dude. But you're not saying that. Like, what do you do in that situation? Do you say to the director, like, or do you play along?
Sam, I'm a can-do guy. I will give it the old college try and see if I can make it happen. Because sometimes, you know, I'm not the final word on the film by any means. So there's producers, there's a director, there's other people whose input may reveal something that didn't occur to me. So my job is to sort of lay it all out there and, you know, do what we can to save it. So it's a collaborative process for sure. And you do what you can. You come up, you know, adversity is the mother of invention. Don't nod your head like that. This is how I get more work, Sam.
You're just doing a job interview. Like, I'm not bringing you on here to pretend you're like...
Is this going out to the public?
Never maligns the director behind their back. You're just like, here, no, it's a collaborative process. It's like those classic like sports clips where like, mm-hmm. you know, the entire team, this is a team win. Right. Everybody pulled their weight.
Yes, really, next man up, you know.
Press conference, Matthew, film guy, or this a real discussion between friends?
Yeah, exactly. Like, huh? What are you trying to do? Get an endorsement now or something? Like,
let's take this offline and you know. No, it's true. It's true. You're right. There's a little bit of that syrup on there, but it's true. So what do you do? What do you say? Sorry, dude, you fucked. Call somebody else. You know, they could do that too. They could hire another editor. That always happens too. But you just do your best. You try to make it work. You have little conversations. You have debates. There's always debating. And in the end, though, you know, listen, I'm here to do a job. I'm a professional.
Oh my God.
Leave it all out on the field. I give 110%. And
I just threw up in my mouth.
What can I tell you, Sam? What answer would...
I'm saying, like, I wish, you know, people could see the evolution of Matthew Film Guy Go from a guy who's going to be frank about his craft to just coming here and pimping himself out for this independent feature film money.
Sam, I contain multitudes. Do you not understand that at this point? I'm still teaching the film class online. Everyone can go sign up at my Twitter and talk about the serious, hardcore art shit, the blow your mind, difficult films that you just don't watch for entertainment. And I have that capacity, too. I'd love to work on a movie like that.
What about eBay Store? Is that still going?
It's sadly between my film career taking off and teaching my class and doing these other podcasts and stuff, I seem to have neglected it. There's a few items on there still.
Podcasts?
Yeah, you know, I went on a This Is Revolution again with Forrest Miller and Kona Neutron, thanks to Gene Bajlan.
How many times have you been on there?
I guess, I don't know, 3 or 4 times now. You know, they have me on when they want to talk. Like, we talked about A Woman Under the Influence. That's a great movie. I wish I would have edited that movie. But I didn't.
You're going on and you're talking Cassavetes on other podcasts.
That's right. That's right. What do you, do I owe you something? Do I give you some, apparently I mean, I certainly mention your name every chance I get.
Apparently not.
No, for sure, Sam, for sure. You know, that's true.
I forgot the other question I had for you now. I forgot the entire line of questioning. I've been so thrown off from
you. Were asking me about Black Bear. I don't know. You wanted to
know. Oh, I know what it was. Whoa. So, have you seen the Beatles documentary?
See, now this is one of the greatest disappointments of this. I'm like literally working dawn till dusk, 7 days a week on this, but I did manage to see the first 2 hours of it. So, I was waiting for this. I've been waiting for this for 50 years, really. And, so finally I got to see this, and I only got to see the first 2 hours, but I'm enraptured. I want to just hang out with the Beatles.
Oh my God.
Horsing around.
It's like
unbelievable.
Like I'm watching them and I'm just like tearing up at random moments of just humor with John and Paul or whatever. It's yeah.
I mean, it's literally like you get in the TARDIS and you get out at Twickenham Studios and you're just sitting around listening to them talk. And if you're a little bit of a Beatlephile, like, I mean, I'm not the biggest one, but I have a friend who is, so he catches me up. You know, there's so many little just things that illuminate the history of their relationship. Like the guy, that publisher who comes in at the end, he's basically, you know who that guy is?
The publisher?
He's the Dr. Business guy that comes in at the end, and they're looking through magazines and they're talking about publishing rights. That's the guy that basically screwed the Beatles out of their catalog.
Is that the one that John, the guy Klein, is it?
No, that's the other guy. That's the business manager that sort of came between them towards the end. No, this is, I'm forgetting his name now. But
that's the guy that screwed them out, which allowed Michael Jackson to purchase their catalog? Okay.
Exactly.
Wow.
Cut forward 40 years from there, and that's the guy. And that's why you can see in that scene, there's such a subtextual tension. Paul doesn't like anything he's saying. You know, there's this one exchange earlier in the movie where they say, who's going to get this money after we die or whatever? And he says him, you know, he mentions his name like offhand because he knows that guy is basically their pimp and they can't do anything about it. But by this point in their career, they're in their late 20s. Now they're starting to realize.
It's so funny. Like I grew up in, you know, the time when iTunes was just starting to be a thing and also LimeWire. And I got so many viruses on like my family computer trying to illegally rip Beatles songs because Michael Jackson was not, sorry, I mean, lock me up.
No, you were musical Robin Hood there. I get it.
Because Michael Jackson and his team, like, they did not make the Beatles available for digital like access for years and years and years. I remember when, like, they finally came on iTunes and Spotify. I mean, when was that? That was, like, it took a long time.
Less than 10 years ago, I think. And they wound up then eventually selling that catalog to Sony for, like, $1 billion. So now it's even out of Paul McCartney's reach, and he's one of the richest men on the planet. So
I think it took Jackson's death for that to happen. Anyway, so,
yeah. And there's there's a lot of great video online about Paul McCartney's ire at what happened and the phone call. He recounts the phone call in a lot of talk shows. If you want to go down a great Google hole, you can find out that.
Sorry, and how, like, I am a big Beatles fan, and how, like, Paul and Michael collaborated after the Beatles broke up, and Michael, like, told him, I'm going to buy your music, and Paul thought he was joking, and he did.
Yeah.
I mean.
But anyway, the documentary has so many little connections to this history, and you're just hanging out with them. I mean, I know there's 60 hours. I would like to see all 60 personally.
Oh, I've heard that Jackson has talked about doing a director's cut that would be like 19 hours.
I would love that. Why not? I mean, it's...
And actually, I went back and read, like, there was an original film. The original guy, the Michael, whatever that guy's
Lindsay
name.
Lindsay Hogg, yeah.
Lindsay
Hogg. Let It Be. Let It Be. I've seen that, too.
Film, and apparently, they cut around a lot of stuff that they were worried would reflect poorly, that I have a feeling is not even in this six-hour one.
Well, the Yoko stuff, I think they cut around a lot.
That's
Yoko
originally, when I read stuff about the 19... whatever it was, seven, they cut around, they mentioned the Yoko Ono stuff.
She brought a bed into the studio and was, like, sleeping there during this album. I mean, there is, like, there was, they're saying this kind of, like, vindicates the Yoko wasn't a problem situation. That's not the case. Yoko Ono's still alive, and I think, they're trying to tiptoe around some of that stuff.
But what
I mean, her just sitting there is, so to me, so funny. She's just reading a magazine while this brilliant shit's going on. I don't understand. Why would she want to?
Yeah, it's codependent and odd.
What I found really fascinating about it was just the generation of how music gets written, at least in those guys, with those guys. Like, I mean, it was for me very, it made me very sentimental for like editing movies or, but really writing, like the writing of like a movie. Cause I don't know anything about music at all. I think I'm tone deaf, and in a million years, I don't understand like do it in this key or that key or octave or any of that stuff or speed it up or pitch or any, I can't hear any of it. And it's like, I'm like, it's like looking
at painting
class and being colorblind, but I could definitely see the similarities. Like sometimes when, you know, in the times that I've written scripts, you start with one line, or sometimes, you know, that a character says, sometimes you start with a vague notion of a scene, or sometimes you start with a story arc. You enter into these things from various different ways, and then you just sort of like build out from what you have, and it sort of evolves in many different directions, and there's never like a time where it evolves in the same way. It's all a function of like what you start out. And I found both fascinating, and it made me sentimental for being in my 20s doing like the comedy lab and cross comedy, like in those days where we just sat around.
Well, how they riff back and forth. I mean, like
smoking cigarettes and not
drinking,
day drinking, yeah. And all that.
They're
miss
smoking
that.
Pot too, which they like try to hide. But like, I mean, the idea.
And actually, John is apparently on heroin at certain points to this too. There's some sort of glassy moments that I feel like I can read into that happening there. But yes, they are enjoying the full pleasures of being celebrities and musicians at that moment.
But how they go back and forth, like, I mean, I'm never was a writer, like, but I've tried to be creative in my past, right? Like, just seeing that, how they could almost read each other's minds or anticipate each other's thoughts. You understand why George feels left out, and he had his own talents, but, like, that was so special, the Lennon and McCartney connection. And it's, like, it's amazing to watch. It really is.
It is, and it's also great knowing that album as well as we all do now. It's not necessarily even close to my favorite Beatles album, but it's probably my least favorite of the post Rubber Soul albums. But it, you hear them getting the inkling and you're like, holy shit, that's where that, oh my God. And that's how that, and listen, I feel for George Harrison. I love All Things Must Pass. That solo album is one of the greatest Beatles creations of any of their solo stuff. And he plays All Things Must Pass and they're like, nah, I don't think so. And,
well, I love
those chords are corny.
Huh? I love I Mean Mine, and they were poo-pooing that too. I mean, like, I know that it's not, Let It Be is my favorite Beatles album. I know that that's not like a popular.
Whoa, soundboard.
And Abbey Road. Those are my two favorites. I really love the late stuff. I really do.
Abbey Road is my favorite. It is my favorite one. And he's got a couple of those from there too. But in any case, it's also my other thing that I just want to say last word on this is, I actually enjoy seeing the workings of Beatles Incorporated going on here. Like, oh, we got to sign this. Oh, we got to do that. You know, they talk about how that really kind of ruined the vibe for them. And plus, this is all in the wake of Brian Epstein, who was like their rock dying. Yeah. So it's sort of like they're out to sea. But all this kind of Beatles Incorporated stuff is so fascinating to me.
Yeah.
The business.
You don't get to say like last word on this. No, I'm not ready to move on.
I'm not.
You just said last word on this.
From me, I can only control myself.
What?
All right. You take the last words.
I was struck by two things, two more things. One is that
they had been, at that point,
so like shell-shocked. Like they were afraid to perform live.
Yeah.
And I think it was because, you know, like I experienced this with some actors who were child stars, that, that experience had been too, there'd been too much exposure at too young of an age. Mm-hmm. And they were, it made them turn in. And they were afraid to be out there. And that's clearly what was also going on. They were afraid of the reaction that they had gotten. Like there was almost like a PTSD quality to them, and that they
needed, the reaction John got when he said the Jesus comment. I mean, that was like,
but I'm just saying, like
even
they,
more. I mean,
like
yeah.
they, you know,
just screaming, just a mania,
yeah.
just.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that they were very much shell-shocked from that, which it never occurred to me, and I think that it came through there. And then the other thing that really also struck me is they are in their, you know, barely late 20s. They are, what, six years into, you know...
Megastardom.
And you look at where they were in 1964 and where they were in 1970, and you get a sense of just how dramatic the cultural shifts were that are reflected in their dress, in their music. I don't know if there has been a period of time in, like, and certainly not in my lifetime, although the last, like, where broadly across the spectrum of society, culture and politics have changed so dramatically over the course of just 6 or 7 years.
It's reflected in Mad Men too, by the way. Like it follows that same track, and you see how quickly the shift is, and how like disorienting it is. And then, you know, you have the war, which is reflected in their music, and then in like that era as well. Like you have MLK and JFK, and the, like those assassinations, how jarring that was for people. I mean, anyway, it's. I'm always yesing.
And listen, there's a reason why it's easy to forget. There's a reason why the Beatles are the Beatles, because they were right at the forefront, driving and following in different measures this cultural shift. They were the pinnacle of the culture at this time. And it's easy to just like think of them as, you know, oh, God, they're, oh, you know, how could they deserve this kind of hype? But they were the peak of what this culture was doing at the time. And, I mean, in large part, they are responsible for a lot of it.
And I guess the last thing I wanted to say was...
No, I got one more thing after that. No, okay, fine.
Billy Preston really got screwed.
I'm not up to his part yet, but I've seen the Let It Be part that where he comes in.
He made that album in big time. And, yeah. You know, as a kid... I never knew about Billy Preston. Mm. I mean, I'm sure more, you know, sophisticated Beatle followers did, but like he really made that album.
Absolutely.
It seems to me.
And he's all over their John and George's, and I think Ringo's solo stuff too. So they definitely knew they struck gold there with him.
Yep. Yep.
But yeah, you're right. You're right.
Well, Matthew, we just have a moment. You want to recommend a quick movie?
You know, what?
Too busy for that now.
I wish I could. You know, you can go follow me on Letterboxd.
Podcast now.
Hey, I can make an hour, you know, every other week, month or so. But you can go follow me on Letterboxd and see what I watch. It's a mix of like art and entertainment kind of films. And thankfully, I still do my class. So I see at least one good movie a week that I then talk about online in the Zoom class that everybody can come and join every Tuesday. At noon, we talk for about an hour and a half to 2 hours about, you know, serious, hardcore, interesting movies with great people. Sometimes the Cedar Sisters are there. One of the films that we watched recently was another one by a guy who I'm just over the moon about. His name is Hong Sang-soo. I think I've mentioned him before. He's a Korean director, and he's made about 30 movies. I've only seen now about half of them, but it's my goal to see them all as fast as possible. And we watched A Woman on the Beach, which, like a lot of his movies, is semi-autobiographical, about a filmmaker who goes out to a vacation spot on the beach with a friend and his girlfriend, and it's sort of a love triangle, and he's trying to write, and it's just very simple, but deceptively simple. His directing style is not showy or flashy, but the way he makes films is unlike almost anybody else. He's been compared a little bit to Eric Rohmer or maybe Woody Allen, but those are sort of surface connections. And I cannot recommend his movies any more highly. They're available on Mubi.com for the most part, also on DVDs and stuff. But I love that. And, you know, and go check out It's a Wonderful Life. Ben Shapiro thinks it's a sad story, but that's a great movie. Frank Capra is one of my favorites. So I agree with Ben Shapiro, actually, that it's a very dark movie. But I only left wondering, why is he celebrating Christmas? Is he a real Jew if he does that?
Hmm.
But besides that, the movie is great. Go with Woman on the Beach by Hong Sang-soo and It's a Wonderful Life.
Matt, film guy, I wish you a happy holidays and a happy new year and health and happiness and success in 2022, and that it doesn't quite go to your head as much as it seems to have at this point.
Thank you, Sam. The same to you. And I hope all you honkies have a good Christmas season, too.
Oh, my gosh. Your band.
It's Crackers.
Your band.
Sorry. Crackers and Honkies. Thank you.
All right. Matthew Film Guy, ladies and gentlemen.
Appreciate it, Sam. Thanks, you guys. Happy New Year. See you later.
Happy New Year.
And so it goes. We're going to do a Freebie Friday.
Oh, wow.
Because it is the last live Friday of 2021.
Mm-hmm. And your last live show of the year.
It is my last live show. There is a slight chance, and I say this every year, that like sometime over the course of the next 2 weeks, I will do like a live show. But this is going to be the longest contiguous vacation from doing the show in 11 years. And I don't know. Prior to that, I was doing like a weekly thing, and then, you know, but at least 11 years. And so I'm going to try and probably get sucked into some type of Twitter fight now with the people who will go unnamed. But who knows? Who knows?
It's Glob.
Very possibly. What should we get to in terms of clips here? We got a lot of good stuff with this going on here.
Oh, Tim Pool.
You want to start with Tim Pool?
Do you have the full context for that?
Is somebody saying that the full context? I don't know if it was a joke, but they said Tim had a point. I don't know. Maybe he doesn't have a point, but I don't know the full context of this Tim Pool almost getting beat up in the studio thing.
Okay. Well, we go back. We have two clips, right? Mm-hmm. Don't we have two clips?
Yeah.
It is interesting because Tim Pool has this rapper, Ra the Rugged Man, on. And
it's R.A. the Rugged Man, I
think. Is it R.A.? I'm sorry. R.A. the Rugged Man. And I have to concede I'm not familiar with this person's music.
A quick Wikipedia search shows that he's worked with Biggie and the Wu-Tang Clan. So got to be pretty
accomplished.
Soon. Yep.
Tim Pool took this down from YouTube, I think. Maybe it was a mistake, and so we should put it back up. In this regard, here is this clip, and I think this is where it starts. We're not 100% sure. Tim Pool has been a little bit playing this close to the vest
by taking it down,
and we should also say that this is just a moment, and there's not a lot to be necessarily garnered from this except for entertainment and watching Tim Pool be afraid that he's going to get beat up in his own studio. That I enjoy. Here is a conversation between Tim Pool and R.A. the Rugged Man is basically saying, dude, you claim that you're trying to make an argument that you're not racist, and you put out some material. And this dynamic, I think, is one that we have noticed on the show with a lot of different people. The gist of your material is this way, but you want to cover your flank, so you put out a little material that way. Mm. And And look,
cover your ass material.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I could see how people might say, like, you know, they look at this show and they go, like, you don't focus on this. You do a couple of videos about that, but you don't focus on it in the way that I think you should.
Right.
And we get that at times. But this is
my favorite kind of critique.
But with, you know, people have an opinion about your shows, whatever. People can have an opinion. But this is different because we're not talking about two different topics. I don't know, I would never criticize Tim Pool for, like, you don't focus enough on the question of racism. No, the point is when he talks about race, he focuses plenty on it. It's just that the emphasis is on one particular dynamic.
That anti-racism is going way too far.
Exactly.
Yes.
And so here's the first of their two exchanges. And I believe, we should just, with a caveat, because again, this has all been deleted and people just got, clips. I believe this is the first part of the sequences of these clips.
To me? Nah, you start raising did your you, voice to me like I'm some sucker. I'm did you laugh at me? Bitch. Yeah, laugh. Did you, you disrespect me? I was nice to you, bro. I was being nice.
You start raising your voice to me like I'm your son, bitch?
You raise your voice to me? Bro, I said I respected
you.
I appreciated you.
Raising your voice shit.
I stopped when you told me to. You said lower your voice, so I lowered my voice. I told you I respected you coming. It was a good show. I said I respected you, willing to admit when you got things wrong. Bro, I have put so much of my life into this. Look at this.
I watch your videos.
You
I already
see this?
Watched your video. No, I see your videos.
You don't. No,
you're going to say, look, this is the non-racist thing. But
the
meanwhile, you have videos promoting Derek Chauvin and acting like he was in the right. You have videos of that. You have videos
we
of the other guy.
On some
you have
things.
Videos of the other. You have videos of the other guy.
Two guys.
Armory. And you go, oh, but they grabbed the pistol, defending them killing a black man in the streets, and he ran for them and giving excuses.
Two guys.
You have these videos, so all of this shit doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
No, of course not.
A decade of work doesn't matter.
No,
because
lives were lost by police, and you were there bootlicking the fucking cops.
I think we should abolish the police.
Okay, now. Okay, so just to just to parse out what's going on here, I think it's obvious, but maybe for people, R.A. the Rugged Man is basically saying, your body of work leans in terms of the question of race.
The idea that Tim has done 10 years of anti-racism work, or even not racist work, is ridiculous. This is he'll occasionally do the thing where, again,
he's just scared. He's being confronted, and the guy's not backing down. Ari the Rugman's not backing down, and Tim Pool has a, don't worry though, he's a very tough guy. He has a samurai sword hanging behind him, crossed with a pistol because he's super tough. But then his voice starts shaking when he's called affirmatively or with authority on his bullshit.
And he's pointing to what I think is a screen that we're going to see in this next clip, which is of a documentary that he financed and actually quoted James Baldwin in.
Jesus.
And this is what I think he was pointing to off camera. Now, I love R.A. the Rugged Man's response when Tim says, I believe in abolishing the police. But Bradley, do me a favor. Go onto your computer and put this up. I want you to Google Tim Pool, abolish the police. Because I think it is the case that Tim Pool has called for the abolition of the... Okay, here it is. Good. Check this out.
Bring back local militias.
Yeah.
Abolish the police. Bring back. Now, the problem with policing is that I think for a lot of people, I think there's a couple issues. There's a sense that, like, our carceral state is problematic, broadly speaking, that you don't want that police abuse their authority, that they target people who are marginal, have marginal political power in our society, and people who have a lower income. What do you think these militias are going to do? Who's going to form these militias? Wealthy people to protect their property and their interests. Where is the history of these militias in this country? They are formed. They sometimes they've been called lynching mobs.
Yeah.
So the idea that he is for abolishing the police in the way that people who want to abolish the police want to abolish the police is, I think, at best, disingenuous.
Well, because there's a second tweet here where he also says the term abolish the police. But it is only in reference to, you guessed it, the January 6th insurrectionist attempt. He says abolish the police, yeah. Quote tweeting a tweet that says breaking the D.C. Department of Corrections locked out multiple members of Congress from reviewing the conditions of the January 6th prisoners.
I mean,
what are they hiding?
He's literally said before that he takes positions that are even contradictory publicly, so people don't know what he actually believes. But and I can't find a date on this, Bradley. Maybe you can help me. But the episode is called "Democrats' Call to Abolish the Police is Massively Unpopular and Freaking People Out Following Widespread Protests." Progressive Democrats seized upon the fervor and called for disbanding, defunding, or even outright abolishing the police. Somehow Democrats managed to turn an advantage into a disadvantage that Republicans have immediately used in their favor. While most people do believe in some kind of police reform, almost no one wants to see the police to be totally abolished, I guess, except Tim.
This is his own podcast. Right, and the thing is that when he's, as you say, he's covering his ass on this because he wants to be able to take both positions or, like, fend off criticism by someone like R.A. the Rugged Man. Like, oh, I want to abolish the police. I want to create militias. And I mean, I'm sure the militias only are able to look a certain way.
10 years, Emma.
Yeah.
10 years of work. Let's.
But what is good about what R.A. the Rugged Man's doing there is he's explicitly calling him out on those critiques directed at acts of racism by police, which you are not going to hear from Tim Pool on.
Here is Tim Pool now pointing to the culmination of his 10 years of anti-racism work.
Yeah.
And R.A. the Rugged Man does not appreciate the way that that Tim is coming at him. And we should say, later in the show, R.A. the Rugged Man apologizes, says, I do have a temper that I know I should... I should be a little bit more restrained, and he apologizes for this moment. But with that said, I do appreciate watching Tim Pool basically pee his pants.
Yeah, and let me just read one more Tim Pool title from 2020. Democrats have just bent the knee to a fringe leftist ideology as progressives vow to abolish police. So his support for abolish the police is kind of interesting.
Well, it's interesting because he's saying Democrats have just bent their knee to me and finally have come around to my position, I guess.
On militias replacing cops?
I guess. Here is that exchange that where R.A. the Rugged Man has had enough of Tim Pool.
You're a racist prick. Here's my hour-long documentary about the black struggle in Ferguson.
Oh, yeah, great. Yeah.
Oh, great. $100,000 budget. Yeah. James Baldwin interviews with people on the ground to talk about what they've been through. And you have the nerve to come up to me and tell me my experiences don't matter when I'm fighting the fight.
Stop screaming, bitch. Stop screaming, first of all. Talk to me like I'm a... Because I'm not that guy.
Yeah, you are. You are. You actually are, dude. Yeah. You are that guy.
I'm not that guy to fuck you. Screaming, bitch. You want to get fucked up?
All right.
What the fuck are you screaming at, bitch?
Let's calm down.
I'm not that guy. You don't disrespect me, bitch.
What did you do to me? Did you disrespect me?
You start raising your voice to me like I'm some sucker.
Did you laugh at me?
Bitch. Yeah, laugh.
Did you disrespect me? I was nice to you, bro. I was being nice.
You start raising your voice to me like I'm your son, bitch?
You raise your voice to me?
That.
Bro, I said, I respected you.
You wouldn't shut the fuck up with that raising your voice shit.
I stopped when you told me to. You said, lower your voice, so I lowered my voice. I told you I respected you coming. It was a good show. I said,
we're going to that. And then she said I had like
he's apologizing.
Some kind of disorder where it's, you get explosive disorder. What the fuck? Intermittent explosive disorder or some shit like that. So what happens is and then afterwards you feel real bad and sad about it, and you feel you fucked up, and you're kind of like, fuck, you know, like you're supposed to keep your cool. So I want to apologize about my outburst because that was a little crazy, and
I outbursted too, man.
Now you have to sing the Best Love Love Me song together in collaboration.
Yeah, you know, and the thing that sucks is that you know, that's the clip we take. And look, you know, this fucking, you know. So it is what it, but you know what? I don't give a fuck anyway. What are you going to do? Ruin my life? I don't care. Well, yeah, put a clip of me going crazy.
No,
my kids, they know daddy's a fucking weirdo. And so when I'm dead and they go on the internet and see me doing weird shit, he's still a great dad. Yeah. So, you know, as long as you're a great dad, you know, so if they got a couple little snippets of me acting up, it is what it is, you know.
I think,
well, dude, I appreciate you coming.
I think,
yeah, so
we made it out alive. We had a good conversation.
I think if the kids are going to be proud of dad for intimidating Tim Pool.
No, that was, I think that was righteous. I think anybody would get frustrated when being lied to by a guy who has a history of
James Baldwin. I put a James Baldwin quote.
Yeah. Did he say James Baldwin interviewed them? I couldn't tell. I mean,
no, he meant that they put a James Baldwin quote at the beginning, in front of the thing.
Well, that's fine, right?
But I mean, there's a Daily Beast article. It's called like how I'll get the title.
You know what Tim does, and he did this when I went on his show some time back. He has multiple channels, and one channel that he has, and I don't know how he does this now, but at the time, one channel is where he builds his audience. Mm. The other channel is where he puts stuff that he knows he needs to have to cover himself, but he doesn't want his audience to necessarily see because it undercuts what he's trying to project to his main money-making channel. So he makes that documentary, but I guarantee you it was not on his main channel. I don't know this for a fact, but I would bet that it was on his like sort of secondary channel. When I went on his show, back when he had the internet and could actually do remote shows. You know, people have clipped it. People can see that, I don't know, somewhere. He put that on his, like, alt channel because I think he was a little bit embarrassed with the way that it went.
Right.
Yeah.
Is that where this was as well?
Oh, this, I bet, no. I don't know if they've put it out yet, but
where it was initially, I guess.
There's this article on, it has a long title, and it's a really long article, and I can't scroll on my phone all the way up, but it's a Daily Beast article. If you search Tim Pool fraud, it's like how a journalist Tim Pool like is a big coward. But there's a section from that Ferguson documentary. Given the heightened tensions in the area and the expanded national conversation about race, many locals were apprehensive when approached by reporters. If you didn't strike the right tone, you could easily be dismissed, and that's what was happening over and over again with Pool, a second staffer present in Ferguson instead. From their perspective, Pool was unable to overcome this obstacle because he was focused on promoting himself. It also seemed as if, quote, any person of color Pool interacted with was with just really had no time for him. The second staffer also remarked that Pool spent an inordinate amount of time while on the ground checking his Twitter feed and, for reasons I couldn't ascertain, touching base with a popular YouTuber named Casey Neistat, who is in town to provide his own coverage.
Ladies and gentlemen, Tim Pool.
That's his
abolish the police activist.
That lets you do about 4 months with material on Jussie Smollett. That balances out for being an anti-racist.
I wonder if his 10 years of anti-racism work qualifies him for being a political ID type of thing or something like that.
But just to underline, R.A., you have the right bead on Tim Pool, and don't feel bad for your outburst.
Oh, well, let him in. We got a special guest.
God, we have a special guest.
I'm terrified. Somebody sent us, like, some chocolate and stuff. Gabe, if you sent it to us, thank you so much. I have eaten about 5,000 of those chocolates now. It's a real problem.
Look who it is.
Oh my gosh, look at this.
Look who it is.
Can we get
here, come over here.
Come say
pretty
hello.
Bad lefty himself is in the studio.
Wow.
In the building.
Very unexpected. Oh my gosh. I came to drop
off look, Christmas in
cookies.
Person.
Yeah, he came to drop off
wow.
Some Christmas cookies in person.
Here,
well,
you're talking to this
you got
to
talk to the mic. We don't have...
Hello, everyone.
There you are.
Look at that. Wow. It's been a long time.
Been a while, Sam.
Since you've been in...
I'm looking in the wrong place. It's been
you
a while,
my
Sam.
Seat?
No, I'm fine.
All right, this is how you can get your, like, squats in.
I've already worked out today. Fine. How's everyone doing? I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, it's good to see you.
It's great.
Happy New Year soon.
Happy holidays. You can Happy say holidays. Merry Christmas again, Sam, or I guess you can't anymore now that Trump is not in office.
I won't do that. I won't do that. I would never say Merry Christmas.
The rash of Christmas tree burnings also has me afraid, Sam. You can admit it.
I'm not afraid to admit that I may have torched a couple people's trees. I'm not going to say who's. You know what? This is actually a good time. This would be fun maybe to just play a the first minute or two of the.
Let's get him a seat at least.
Yeah, can we get this? Can this mic come on?
That mic can come on? All right.
I didn't mean to be a bother.
Yeah, pull that around there. Oh, what? We got that drill is out there. Why do I have that drill there? Did you take that drill out?
Well, I asked if I could borrow that drill, and then I just put it on that table. Remember, because my bed broke.
Yeah, why'd you put the drill there?
I don't know. It was
slide over. You okay. Slide over. Watch. Okay. Oh boy. Oh boy.
I'm a little wide.
It's been a little while since we. Okay, watch that cord on the ground there. Jesus. Oh God. All right. This is
a great broadcasting. Whoa,
this is, we did not, I mean, this studio has not been set up for.
There we go.
Perfect. All right. Do you have that clip?
Over there.
Bradley, do you have this is my, I mentioned that earlier, the War on Christmas clip of me. See if you can find that.
Anarchy in Majority Report.
This is my favorite appearance
here, I'm moving over this
on TV that I did maybe I don't know 12 years ago. Let's see.
How is Brandon going to be able to hear?
Oh, don't you? Isn't there a plug there? There should be a plug there somewhere.
I'm just
you may think.
But what I'm wearing right now is soft body armor.
Maybe that's the right cord.
Yeah, are we getting body armor ads on our ads? On our show?
Oh, I found it.
Look at that.
I'll send it to Hangouts.
Here, I'll send you a clip. Here we go.
Can you hear it?
I can hear you all. Ooh. And I can hear
Bradley
myself.
Right
yeah,
there.
Look
and
at that.
If you go to about a minute in, go to 1 minute in on that one. Now, the quality of this is bad because we keep doing this. Like over the years, we keep pulling it off of YouTube, and then reshooting it again as we put it up. And so it looks like it was like drawn like an impressionist painting at this point, but it was actually on television at one point. Do you have it, Bradley?
Yep.
Okay. So just a little bit of an introduction to this. We usually play this right after Thanksgiving, when the war is officially launched. I don't know if you've ever seen this, Brandon.
I mean, I probably have. You know, the war on Christmas has been raging for as long as I've been alive.
That's right. And back in, I think this was back in, I don't know. We were playing it like in 2012 as a sentimental thing in 2012. So this was probably back in 2004 or 5. So I look a little bit younger. I don't want anybody to get too disturbed by it. And I got invited on to CNN to talk about the war on Christmas. And I, of course, I was invited on with the head of Concerned Women of America. This is a right-wing organization. And its president, a man named Bob Knight. Here is that clip it was with. I can't remember who the host was, but here it is.
War on Christmas. And hundreds of billions of dollars in taxpayer.
Stop. Go back another couple of seconds. Get back a little bit more. Sorry. Try it there. Yeah. Go back.
Oh, I see you.
Go back. Yeah. Yeah, that's Bob Knight right there. Yeah. Concerned Women of America, of course. Keep going. Sorry, I don't know. Oh, wait. This is not the one I sent you. Okay, that's why you shouldn't do... keep
Matthew
going back.
Film guy ripped
go
off
back,
your glasses
go back,
from this.
Go back.
Start at the beginning.
I said 1 minute in on the one that I sent you. Okay, go ahead. Right there.
Is that Nancy Grace?
Well, Merry Christmas or Happy Holidays, a Christmas tree or a holiday tree? Which should it be? Depends on whom you ask. We've seen controversy, most notably prompted by the White House. It sent out cards, this card, matter of fact, wishing a holiday season of hope and happiness. No mention of Christmas. Some thoughts now on the subject. Sam Teeter hosts the show Majority Report on Air America Radio.
Pause it for 1 second. Now, I should tell you a couple of things. One, this is on CNN. They're taking this seriously at this time. And understand, this was raging. This is just to give you a sense of just how nuts things were. The other thing you should know is I got very lucky in this situation because they were supposed to go to Bob Knight first, but his microphone didn't work. So in like the last second, I heard the producer in my ear, we're going to go to you first. And that was really problematic for Bob Knight. All right, go ahead.
Bob Knight is the director of the Culture and Family Institute. It's affiliated with the Christian conservative organization Concerned Women for America. Gentlemen, great to have you with me.
Thanks for having us on.
All right, well, let's start with the holiday card. What do you think, Sam?
Well, listen, you know, as far as the war on Christmas goes, I feel like we should be waging a war on Christmas. I mean, I believe that Christmas, it's almost proven that Christmas has nuclear weapons, can be an imminent threat to this country, that they have operative ties with terrorists. And I believe that we should sacrifice thousands of American lives in pursuit of this war on Christmas. And hundreds of billions of dollars of taxpayer money.
Well, Sam, is it a war on Christmas, a war on Christians, a war on over political correctness, or just a lot of people with way too much time on their hands?
Well, I would say probably, if I was to be serious about it, too much time on their hands. But I'd like to get back to the operational ties between Santa Claus and Al-Qaeda.
I don't think that exists. Bob?
Well, we have
help
intelligence.
Me out here.
We have intelligence.
You have intel. And where exactly does your intel come from?
Well, we have tortured an elf. And that's it's actually how we got the same information from Al Labee. That's exactly the same way the Bush administration got this info about the operational ties between Al-Qaeda and Saddam.
Okay, Bob Knight. Sam is tying in now the lack of information regarding weapons of mass destruction and somehow moving that into Santa Claus. Help me out here. What's going on? I mean, is this a war on Christians, a war on Christmas? Is this too much political correctness?
Yeah, it was very, first I want to compliment him on his dry humor, but this is actually a very serious subject because a lot of people are waking up to realize that the war on Christmas is really the culmination of a war on faith. And the idea that the public square has to be cleansed of any religious expression, particularly Christian religious expression. You know, at one time, Happy Holidays was a welcome addition to Merry Christmas, so you wouldn't say the same thing over and over again. But a lot of people now see it as a substitute, and it's very gratuitous at times. And it's actually insulting when you're talking about Christmas Day or a Christmas tree, and you can't bring yourself to use the word for fear of offending someone. In the name of diversity, we're a less free country when that happens.
Pause it for one second. Does any of that sound familiar to you?
It's just weird.
Like, if you could put Barry Weiss and just move her lips like this, or any of those IDW people, or any of these, like, you know, so-called First Amendment people, or all the people who are complaining about the woke culture. There was nobody ever said the word woke in 2005, but this has been relentless. This is all the same. It is all the same. The talking points are just slightly nuanced in their difference, but it's all just coming from an attack on right-wing fundamentalism on some level. But just play it out here because things get a little bit, I enjoyed this. Let's put it that way.
And because, I mean, this is a time where if anything, we want to be even more sensitive to diversity, considering everything that's happening with regard to war on terror. We're learning so much more about different religions, different ethnicities, and trying to become more of one versus being segregated.
Yeah, well, Kara, I mean, listen, I would like Bob to tell me who is the person who has been offended by someone saying Merry Christmas to them. I've never met that person. I don't celebrate Christmas. But if someone says Merry Christmas to me and I either think, well, it's a little bit odd. It's like me saying happy birthday to you on my birthday. But, you know, no one cares. But I'll tell you this. As we wage the war on the war on the war on the war on Christmas on our radio show, News Corp, Fox News, those people who have started this entire war on Christmas meme, fake war, they're having a holiday party. President Bush saying happy holidays, Tokyo Rose, Laura Bush, saying happy holidays to her dogs in the video. I'm sure you've seen it. I mean, these are the things that we should be talking about when we are waging this war in Iraq,
We should be equating it to the war on Christmas. What else would Bob Knight have an opportunity to do? How else would he get on television if he wasn't pretending to be attacked?
You know, this would be funny, except it is serious to a lot of people who have seen their faith cleansed from the public square systematically.
Bob, are you suggesting, Bob, that someone can't celebrate Christmas in America? I mean, tell me about the person who can escape these
celebrations. Get a word in here.
Go ahead, Bob. Go ahead, Bob.
I'm talking about things like in Ridgeway, Wisconsin, where the school children in the public school were told they couldn't sing Silent Night, so they substituted O Cold Night. You know, I think when you take Jesus out of anything, it gets pretty cold, so it's apt. But it's outrageous. They had children actually singing a bastardized version of Silent Night.
Well, Bob, this may come as a shock to you, Bob.
But
I don't consider Jesus the Messiah. And so if you're going to ask me to praise Jesus, I'm going to be a little offended. I don't think the singing of the song, that you can find other songs to sing. So what about Silent Night?
So because you're offended, none of those other kids can celebrate the great heritage of Christmas.
I'm not the one who said they couldn't do that. No, I'm not the one who said
you're a Grinch,
but you're trying to force. Why are you trying to force conversions on people?
Let me ask you guys.
Yes, you are, singing a Christmas carol.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you guys about the pressure that's been put on stores.
People can go and look up the rest of that. I at one point accuse him of I think calling me a Nazi, and I wasn't 100%. I was a little disingenuous when I was doing that, but I was trying to make a point.
I just have to. I'm glad I'm here because you know the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing people that the war on Christmas does not exist.
Yeah,
and you know while everyone is in the streets concerned about their brains being fried by Havana syndrome and you know Habana syndrome, however you choose to pronounce it, you know Christmas tree syndrome is slowly and insidiously affecting millions of Americans in this holiday season. And, you know, Sam, you think it's all fun and games when the, you know, moms against drunk driving in Christmas trees or whatever is a dude and makes fun of you on CNN. But this is a real big...
Concerned Women of America.
Yes, Concerned Women of America.
Associated with the drunk driving. Yeah. Although I feel like he seemed like he was maybe trying to loosen up a little
bit. He seemed like he was a little mad. Right.
Oh, yeah, he got mad when I started accusing him of calling me
driving.
A Nazi. He claimed that he did because he brought up, of course, what happened in The Sound of Music, which, of course, is incredibly relevant to.
That seems to be also another through line with right wingers. They love references from movies and try to apply
references.
Them. Yeah, I mean, again, like if you were to have this debate now, we'd be talking about Thanos.
Yep. It's just really interesting. There's a through
trying
line.
To eliminate all the Christmas trees.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is a Christmas tree shortage, I think, right? That's one of the things that are not being stocked fast enough this holiday season, Christmas trees. Is there a menorah shortage, Sam?
As far as I know, there was plenty of menorahs this time of year. Hmm. Because, I mean, there's no, you know.
You don't buy those every year, though.
You don't buy new ones every year. You usually tend to not. There's generally not a huge run on menorahs.
That is very convenient.
Yeah.
That's a very convenient, you know, excuse. Although I will say there is...
We know what we're doing. Let's put it that way.
Curious that the supply chain did not affect the menorahs, huh?
Well, I mean, listen, I know a guy who can get me a menorah at wholesale. So it's not an issue.
No Antifa vigilante burned down the Fox News menorah this year. You know?
Well, I mean, they did, but it lasted eight nights. So, it worked out well. That was the good thing about the menorah burning this year.
It's just good to see, you know, in the spirit of the founding of America, that there's a through line of, you know, Christian fundamentalists believing that it's oppression if they don't get to proselytize enough to people.
But that dynamic is really the structure of all of the complaints about wokeism, about infringing on free speech. It is the exact same thing. It is an aggrievement that is set there because in any way there is inclusion. That's what he's complaining about. He's claiming in 2000, and you know, we now have, you know, the benefit of hindsight and see that in fact Christianity has not been cleansed from the town square. It is not yet, but I mean, does anybody think that, you know, that there's been any more cleansing of Christianity from the town square, particularly when we look at the Supreme Court, over the course of the past 15 years? No, and this is the same thing. They're complaining about the idea that people are starting to respect Islam at that time in particular, that there's a diversity of perspectives that are starting to be introduced, that gay people are actually, like, people are starting to talk about them getting married, all of these things. it is the same structure. When you hear other people complain about wokeism or, you know, CRT.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I think that even in that one clip, she, you know, she turns the war on terror around to be like, didn't, if the war on terror taught us anything, it's that we should respect Christians more. And that becomes like this sort of underlying, I guess, rationale around these kinds of aggrievement stories that like, we might just go too far in the wrong direction if we do things like CRT or affirmative action and end up in a world where, you know, Christian white males are the ones who feel oppressed. And so any even step in that direction, whether it's like not singing Christmas songs in public school or like teaching them about slavery, becomes like an encroachment or possible encroachment on the rights of a, you know, majority of silent Americans who just want things to be like they always have been, I guess. But, you know, even that's nostalgia. It's, you know, it's a, it is a remembrance of a Christian Christmas tradition in America that is like usually just born from watching movies, like It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah. It also erases power from the conversation on purpose, right? When was this, when did this air? What year?
I think it was 2005, okay. I think was the, when we were on CNN.
So like exactly, right? Now the, what this entire time period is doing is teaching us to respect all religions as if they are in equal footing in the eyes of the American people and in the way that the American empire is currently exerting power in 2005, right? I mean, that's like, That's the erasure that's on purpose.
Yeah, I mean, that's how you get All Lives Matter, because Black Lives Matter doesn't specifically speak to the, you know, the concerns of Christmas and white people.
Yeah.
On some level, you know, like this was the big, it was Kira Phillips was the anchor, the big proponent, if I remember at the time, O'Reilly was a big War on Christmas guy. There was another guy, I want to say Tony, somebody who went on to be, I think, one of Bush's spokespeople, and then there was another guy, and I can't remember his name, that even wrote a book about the war on Christmas at the time. Tucker Carlson is the descendant of that. I mean, he has adopted that mantle, and it's more like things like COVID, and it's now things are a little bit more coded. It is more like normal people now. Instead of saying Christians, they would never say you're taking Jesus out of the thing, but you would say you're attacking our values. This is, you know, you wouldn't say at the time wokeism, but you would say like this, you know, sort of offensive insistence that because you're offended, other people can't celebrate Jesus in public school. And on one hand, the interesting thing is, from a cultural standpoint, they've had to retreat a little bit, right? They have to layer another level of coding, the wording. The position's the same, but the wording is different. But in a structural fashion, in terms of the law, they're actually making big strides. There was no RFRA. Or at least not as applied as it is today, the Religious Freedom Redemption Act or whatever it is, which essentially provides all these different loopholes to federal law if you are if you claim to be religious. And this is the sort of like the dual track we're on. They are, you know, maybe losing a little ground culturally, and but they are certainly gaining it in terms of the laws. Which I don't know. It's a little bit disturbing in that respect. Let's go. Since we're talking about wokeism,
Brandon, I mean, like, what's your schedule like?
Oh, I mean, I don't want to interrupt you guys in your show. I came to drop off some cookies and, you know, preach the gospel of.
What kind of cookies is it?
So many sweets. It's a real problem.
They are, you know, I'll get up and grab a box so I can show them off. Hold on 1 second.
There you go.
I got a real problem with sweets.
With sweets.
Somebody sent us a chocolate, and I almost ate it until I almost vomited.
Stomach ache.
Here, push the tighten your.
I did it with the camera, but he just got to get closer. Right. Maybe I'll zoom out. That's what I will do.
I think zoom out would be the better. Yeah.
Yeah.
Here you go.
Oh my god!
Oh my god! Oh, this is so nice of you.
Crap.
Are these for me?
Yeah, this is homemade. There's another box in there. Two boxes over there for.
Wait, you got boxes for each of us?
Well, I mean,
I'm supposed to eat this whole thing?
Hold them up for the camera, one of you.
Yeah, well, I'm going to try and, like, open it. It's like it's one of these magic boxes. One of the things like you gotta press a button.
It's a like some sort of trick box.
Did you make these?
No, they were homemade though. So.
Oh wow!
What?
Yeah.
That's so cute.
Oh,
I mean.
Oh wow!
Well, yeah.
This is what I did to the Fox News one.
I know, right?
Sam, already complaining about a stomachache. Going in for a new cookie.
Oh damn!
Oh my god!
That's too good.
Is this like
Oh shit!
What's is this butter? Butter like what's the name? Buttercream.
I got a real problem here.
Oh, and then cookies with the
so yeah, there M&M's are there are sugar cookies in here.
Was that monster
cookies? Frosting? Yeah, monster cookies.
The greatest
and some
cookie.
Millionaire shortbread.
That is the greatest cookie.
My mom sends me cookies from monster cookies from North Dakota.
Oh my god,
they really are the best.
And then fudge?
No, it's caramel.
Oh, caramel, but it's, still.
Yeah, millionaire shortbread. So enjoy. Have a wonderful Christmas season.
This is, very yeah, thank kind you,
Brandon.
Of you.
Brandon's no, no, so you know, nice.
It's not. It's absolutely not.
Were you
me.
In the neighborhood, or did you just like?
I was in the neighborhood. I mean, well, I was in the neighborhood to drop these off and also go shopping.
Oh.
So.
Oh my god.
Well, I mean, that's like truly incredibly nice. Maybe I'm. Maybe I'll pass these off and say I made them. Huh.
Oh my god.
Give them to people.
You can do whatever you want with the cookies.
No, I won't.
So
I
good.
Do that
you can
too.
Eat them. You can pass them off as your own.
I am gonna.
Those
eat
are
them.
Probably the only two things you can do with them.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Thank you.
No, you're welcome.
Very much. Much appreciated. Well, I mean, do you want to stick around or what do you want to do?
Well, you know what? I will leave you guys today. I don't want to.
You'll be back Thursday?
Of course I'll be back Thursday. Right. Thursday, you're recording?
Thursday is the last live show of the year.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Maybe
you
I'll show up in person for that one, too.
Ooh,
you know, come
that
by
would be nice.
Come by since, you know.
That would be nice because, yeah. You know, it's just me on those days, as we well know.
Absolutely. So, you know
well,
what?
I mean, there'd be other people there, too.
There, no, I mean, yeah, I just...
Wow, Matt getting completely canceled. It's like Dr. Oz over there.
It's the only the on-camera people matter, so...
There's a hierarchy of importance.
Damn.
Where's my whistle thing? I should have done the shoot.
But yeah, I've interrupted your
well, Brandon,
show enough.
Thank you so much for the cookies. Delicious. I'm going to try and not eat all of them.
You can share them. You know,
I'm going to try and share them, but I can't guarantee that I will, frankly.
Well, that's why
I have a real problem.
Well, if I had
can't
known.
Even like not eat them right now. I'm just going to finish this one. And
okay.
Then
well, it's actually, been a pleasure.
I find distance is usually the best thing.
Will you just do me a favor? Just put them on the couch.
Thanks. I will take these away from you, and they'll be on the couch where you can pick them up after you are done with the
I have
report.
A very bad sweet tooth.
I don't, luckily.
But you like inflicting it upon others.
Oh, well, inflict is a harsh word.
I don't think I've ever had, like, frosting on a cookie like this.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, man,
it's the buttermilk frosting, right?
Well,
I don't think I've ever had anything like that.
Buttercream.
Buttercream, yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll see you guys later. Enjoy the cookie.
All right. Thank
All right.
you so much.
Thank you, Brandon.
Hi,
you.
Audience, as well. Bye, audience.
Holy cow.
See you, Brandon.
Damn it. Yeah, 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 yeah. Oh, will you please eat those, Matt? Oh, shit. He's got Matt and Bradley their own boxes. That's bad news for me. That's bad news.
Thanks,
Very
Brandon.
Very dangerous. I got a real problem. Bye, guys. Thank you so much. All right. Well, that was a fun
Such
interview.
A lovely surprise.
Yep. All right. Let's do a couple more clips here. We were just talking about woke culture, as it were. I don't know if you know what's happening in Florida, but Florida has become a ground zero for wokeness in the country, as I'm sure many of you know.
In addition to, like, COVID outbreaks and stuff like that?
Yeah. And well, they don't have a lot of COVID right now, of course, and they're convinced it's not coming back. As you know, Dave Rubin has packed up and is moving to Florida as we speak. And why? Because it's so not woke there. And he's going to be moving to the Panhandle, what they call the Redneck Riviera, where I'm sure... No, actually, he's not. That's a conservative area. He's going to be moving to an area that I'm sure is...
I'm sure Miami.
How much do you want to bet that they move? He moves into a majority Democratic district. I wonder why that would be.
I'm gonna say there's like a what we're gonna put the odds at -150 for Miami or Miami-Dade County, and then +150 for.
You think he'll live in Kissimmee?
For him to go to Palm Beach.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be Miami. I think we need a remix of Will Smith's Miami song with a Dave Rubin sort of overlaid. But I also, like we say, there's not a whole lot of cases in Florida, but Florida adds 8,785 new cases. Biggest rise in September they're dealing with now. So it looks like it's going right back up.
Wow, that's very surprising, despite the fact that they don't have to be going inside like we do up here in the Northeast and in the Great Lakes area. But here is Governor Ron DeSantis beginning or continuing to run for the nomination in the event that Donald Trump keels over in 2024, introducing the Stop Woke Act.
What you see now with the rise of this woke ideology is an attempt to really delegitimize our history and to delegitimize our institutions. And I view the wokeness as a form of cultural Marxism. They want to tear... They want to just, it's not just, you know, people say, oh, you know, they're leftists or socialists. It's not just like taxes and all that. Yeah, they do want that, and that's not good. But they really want to tear at the fabric of our society and our culture and things that really we've taken for granted.
Yeah, things we've taken to granted, like white supremacy. How many of us here have really stopped and really appreciated the fact that as white people, as that we have had supremacy in this country?
I think the way like white supremacy and like slavery, for instance, interests me not as a cultural Marxist, but just as a Marxist, actually.
Yeah.
And to be clear, folks should understand, this is identity politics. This is identity politics. Identity politics are not just when you decide that there have been groups of people who have been systemically and structurally oppressed over the course of 400 years. It's also when the people who've been doing the oppressing basically say, we're going to strike back. You're not going to get rid of the institutions, the symbolism, the structures,
the economic system
that has allowed us to maintain this supremacy. And when you do, you are attacking our heritage.
You're a cultural Marxist. You know, like, do you think that he watches Fox News or like hears Marjorie Taylor Greene talk and just writes down all the buzzwords possible and then just says, like, I'm going to hit all of these points for my 2024 run? He really thinks that he's like...
He cultivates the media as much as anybody. I mean, we showed like the Dave Rubin stuff, but Dave's had photo ops with him. They're very funny pictures because DeSantis has an interesting tailor.
Yeah.
Like DeSantis is really plugged into like the Ben Shapiro's type, and like I think that's his bet to run. Like, he wants those guys locked up.
And what does stop woke mean? It means go back to sleep, basically. Yeah. Right?
The
stop being awake.
But the point that you guys are making about his being so attenuated to right wing talkers, that's what Donald Trump was. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump got all of his politics from right wing talk radio. Mark Levin, Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, Rush Limbaugh, who he gave a medal to. He was a walking, essentially, sponge of right-wing talking points. And I think DeSantis realizes this is his ticket to ride as well. Stop the wrongs to our kids and employees is the woke act.
That's one of my favorite parts of politics. Like, an underrated comedic element is how they shoehorn like acronyms. Yeah.
You mentioned the thing about the Trump. There's a interesting Vic Berger edit that kind of shows a little bit more of this DeSantis inspiration coming from Mr. Donald Trump. If you have that, Bradley.
A look at this video.
Our most valuable player, MVP governor for conservatives, Ron DeSantis of Florida, talking about the press and fake news, okay?
I don't trust the premise of the question. But yes, I would like to see some validity to what they're saying before I indulge the premise. Thing that showed that their narrative was a piece of horse manure.
It's so insulting when they write phony stories that they know are fake news, because they're not insulting me, they're insulting everybody, these incredible people that have worked so hard, so long, that are thinking about nothing other than this invisible enemy.
Our peak hospitalized census for COVID patients was about 9,600 over the summer. And it shows you how dishonest, these are smear merchants,
sick people, and they put that crap together. So
that's why nobody trusts corporate media.
Would anybody like a pen?
Oh, he's Sharpie guy.
Would anybody like a pen? 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 Would anybody like a pen?
You know, yes. Who else is a Sharpie guy?
Who's that?
Who likes writing with Sharpies?
I have no idea who you're talking about.
No, you go, I have no idea what you're talking
about. I have no idea what you're saying.
Not a clue.
About the Sharpie point. None whatsoever. None. No. Have no idea. Want a pen? Everybody, want a pen?
Is that a pen or is it a
Sharpie?
This is going to be like the Pete Buttigieg Obama situation.
Yeah.
Every politician is going to start talking like Trump.
He is copying me. That's what's going to be like if they get on stage with each other.
I'm
he's copying
the real thing.
I'm the real thing. And little Ron. Little Ronnie. I call him Little Donnie.
Oh, man.
That's what I call him. I call him Little Donnie Ronnie.
If
Ronnie Donnie. That's what I call him.
If DeSantis runs against Trump, it's going to be as exciting as the 2016 GOP primary.
Yeah.
Little Ronnie Donnie DeSanta Trumpist. Yeah. That's what I call him. DeTrumpist. DeTrumpist.
DeTrumpist.
Because he wants to be me. But he's not me. He's a copy. He's a copy of me. Right? Right, Ron? Don? You call yourself Don?
I feel like if Trump runs, DeSantis is going to angle for VP or something like that. Like that, I mean, I don't know. Unless his ego is big enough that he thinks he can take on the real thing.
That actually sounds like a strong ticket, Trump-DeSantis.
It does.
White on white. White on white.
Let's go with what we know it works.
Let's go with, let's double down. Double down. So this is a fun interview. You'll recall the other day, Christian Walker, who is Herschel Walker's son, was bemoaning the fact that at what apparently turns out to be one of the most expensive gas stations in Beverly Hills, someone told me. Is he in Beverly Hills, Christian Walker?
I don't know if that's I would guess that Herschel Walker does not just reside in Georgia. I would guess that he has multiple places that he lives.
I don't know. That's unconfirmed. But it was at very, very, very expensive gas station. Because in New York, we have a big gas tax. And it's hard to find gas that's even at $4 a gallon. Apparently, where he was, it was closer to like $4.50 or $5. And people called him out because he was driving a gas-chugging Range Rover and wearing a $1,300 hoodie. And then he went on to shoot a subsequent video where he basically said, you know, if you don't have money, people are mad that we have money because otherwise you're lazy. Remember, the original video was ostensibly feeling sympathy with these lazy people who couldn't afford the gas. So it was a little bit convoluted. He sat down with Mark Lamont Hill on, was it the Black News Channel, they call it, on YouTube. And this is what happened.
When you made your video the other day and you said, you know, the kind of boo-hoo video, and you're like, I'm sorry my parents weren't lazy and they actually got up and worked and, you know, built businesses and did things like that. Can you see how a comment like that would make a working class American feel insulted or to make a person who's struggling, someone who's working poor, feel as if you're blaming their condition on their laziness and not the economic circumstances? Could you at least see that position?
No, I can't see it. All the working class followers of mine loved the video because they saw that a lot of Democrats were refusing to engage with the point I was making, that gas prices were high, and instead wanted to focus on my Givenchy sweater and my Range Rover. So I made a video saying, oh, am I supposed to be ashamed that my parents worked hard? That has nothing to do with working class people. Americans, whether you're poor, rich, or anywhere in between, can care about issues that don't directly affect them. Yes, I can afford $98 gas, but I care about my fellow working class American citizens. That's what the video was about, and it was about Democrats refusing to engage with my point and instead distracting on some of the material items that I have. That had nothing to do with the conversation. It was a funny video. It was a joke.
No, again, I remember I started this conversation by saying, I'm not taking issue with your Givenchy or your Range Rover. My only point was the whole, my parents worked hard. I'm telling you that many people, and maybe we live in different social media universes, which makes sense. I'm, you know, a very old man. Many working poor, working class people I saw were insulted by that. So I'm just saying, if you're trying to reach out across the aisle and not just the people who already follow you and already agree with you, it could be a very complicated thing. Another thing you talked about was,
I mean, you got to hand it to what's the face, Christian Walker, for being able. I mean, he's pretty. He was pretty good at diverting the point there. The idea that he is suggesting that his wealth is a function of his parents working hard, as opposed to everyone else who doesn't have a $1,300 hoodie or a Range Rover. Is indicative of what this guy's politics is. And it really shows just how disingenuous he was to his fellow working class people. should be clear, he's not working class. His fellow working class people about their plight when it comes to gas was the subtext of his videos were that they deserve it because they're just lazy.
I mean, he really got that smug thing down. He just grins from ear to ear and like is just unabashed. I feel like, I mean, I don't know.
He's pretty good in that instance. I wonder what would happen if somebody really pressed him on that point. But it's going to be interesting to see how much of a liability, if he is at all, to his dad running down in Georgia.
Also, did he poll the working class Americans on his Instagram or TikTok about their opinions on his Givenchy sweatshirt?
I'm going to guess that the ones that did have a problem with it probably have unfollowed him for a while now. And most of the people aren't working class or at least working poor, for instance.
Yes, please. One more clip from that interview. Givenchy. I did not know how to pronounce that.
I thought it was Givenchy, but, you know.
You can say whatever you want about a white person and not get fired from your job. You say one comment about a black person, you're done.
Do you have any examples? Again, I'm just asking.
There's so many, I can't even come up with one right now. even on Twitter Space.
There are so many that you can't come up with any.
No, it's like a
log jam of examples and you just can't.
Meanwhile, he's talking to a black guy who got fired from his job.
Yeah.
For talking about Israelis. Not even when he was at work.
Yeah.
And yet, somehow Christian Walker is aware that of the oppression that white people have, that if they talk about a black person, they get fired from their job. And there's so many examples of that, that he cannot remember one.
Yeah, it's just flooded his brain. I will say he definitely seems like a Herschel Walker's son.
There is an affliction that sometimes when you have so many options, you become paralyzed And it's possible that he's thinking of so many instances that he's aware of white people being fired for talking about a black person that he cannot actually articulate.
Sensory overload.
Yep.
Yep. That's mostly what it was.
That's probably what it was. So we'll see. But good for Mark Lamont Hill for engaging that guy.
And that would be tough for me. That would be tough for me to have a conversation with that person.
I think I would enjoy it.
I mean, but you're you.
I know. I like to argue.
What?
I think that's sort of like entitled, the Christian Walker sort of like entitled, that is the future of the Republican Party if they have one. I mean, it's part of the future of the probably Democratic Party too, but like that is an empowered group of people. And I think that like his attitude there, like people think it's so repugnant. I think that appeals to a lot of people.
That not only is that the future of the Republican Party, it's the past of the Republican Party. It's Ted Cruz. It is Josh Hawley. It is, I mean, we can go on and on and on. I'm here talking about the working class. And incidentally, I'm also an incredibly elite. I'm in the elite. It's Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson, who never, never, never had to want for a moment in his life as an economic perspective, who not only was wealthy since a fairly young age, but also had every elite connection and advantage that one could exist, and yet somehow was completely attuned to the way that working class people felt left out by the elites, of which he continues to be one, and all of the inside dealing that exists in that world. Speaking of Tucker Carlson, what clip number is this? Number 10. Guess who Tucker had on his show?
Who?
Sam, this is a special documentary. This
I was going to say, this is not the show. This
oh,
was
sorry.
He's been working on this for quite a while. They had the inside, behind-the-scenes look at Kyle Rittenhouse.
Oh, that's nice. The inside the 18-year-old who had achieved... You know, what a lot of 18-year-olds do not achieve by the time they're 18, very few 18-year-olds have the opportunity to say, I killed two people in protecting a Piggly Wiggly and then became a celebrity because of it. Here's the documentary.
Oh, Kyle Rittenhouse!
It is so nice to meet you.
It's really good to meet you.
I can't believe you're
here. Big fan of your show.
We're fans of yours, as you know.
Yeah.
Yep, that's me. You're probably wondering how I ended up in this situation.
No, we know. For most Americans, Kyle Rittenhouse is more meme than man. But in real life, Rittenhouse is a working class kid from the least privileged sector of our society.
I worked at Six Flags as a custodian. I was a fry cook. I fried cheese curds, fish.
Rittenhouse was a lifeguard and a firehouse cadet. He did this to support his family and to help his community. But under the rules of anarcho-tyranny, you're not allowed to protect your community. Protecting his community is just what Kyle Rittenhouse felt compelled to do. So tell me, Kyle...
Oh, for 1 second. Under the rules, apparently, of anarcho-tyranny, and just to be clear, this wasn't his job. To protect his community.
And it was not his community.
Well, you know, you could argue that, like, he it was probably the nearest, you know, town to where he lives. It 10 minutes, 20 minutes away. I don't know. But it wasn't his job. It wasn't his job. And also, we should say, like, it's not quite clear that there was any threat to the community. I don't know what that was. But, like, it's not his job. There are people whose job it is. But apparently under anarcho-tyranny, you can't also be an amateur policeman, or really not policeman, just sort of like an amateur self-appointed guard of property.
Tim Pool would be kind of into that, right? Like he's a militia.
Yeah, he could break out his sword. But let's watch this. I love this, like...
That's pretty much it.
And why did Tucker like laugh so maniacally?
Because he does that all the time.
That is so awkward and weird.
Yeah. My favorite part too, and it just fits into something Tucker's been doing for a while. When he calls him a member of the quote least privileged sector of our society, this is a way to undercut and stave off the like talk of white privilege, right? This is a way for him to basically say, no, black people, non-white people, POC, women, they, or maybe not women to an extent, but definitely the groups before, they have a like a privileged status because the liberal elites want to erase white people or erase culture or elevate these kinds of people. So actually, the least privileged are, if you're from this class group, which, by the way, I support all the policies that would not uplift you from a class basis, and also you being white. And so that's something that he is, like, one of the many side projects in his commentary. That's one that I think we need to pay attention to.
There actually is one more short
clip. Let's watch one more short clip from this. Incidentally, sweet, what is it, like a $500-$600 gun? He must have earned that by being a fireman cadet.
Before last summer, Kyle Rittenhouse wanted to move to the paradise of Florida, to the free state. Now he has his chance. Even so, he will never have the luxury of living a normal life. He'll never be able to erase the slander and stigma laid on him by the media and by his prosecution. Those are the consequences of the trial of Kyle. The next time, it could be you.
The next time you kill two people and wound a third, you could be held somewhat accountable and adjudicated by the law. Be careful. The next time you decide... The funny part is, what did he say? The anarcho, what is it? The
anarcho-tyranny.
Picking up a gun and deciding that you're going to be in charge of making sure that nobody breaks into the Piggly Wiggly sounds a little anarcho to me, frankly. And having a gun when you're meeting protesters who have like a skateboard or something, that also seems a little tyrannical to me. And the idea that he's been slandered by the judicial system because he was prosecuted for killing two people. He killed them. Killed them dead. Dead.
I like how it's the media reaction to him taking two lives that's going to F him up for the rest of his life and not having killed two people.
Right. You can get past the shooting the two people because they were armed with a skateboard. And they were coming after you for being there with a gun in a menacing fashion. That you can get past. But the indignity of going to trial and having to cry when you're on the witness stand, that is horrible.
Is there any like doubt now that kid was faking it? Like, I mean, I'm sure he was stressed, but like that's the point though, right? Like the fact that he's being lionized and being made into this martyr by conservative media, I understand his brain's still forming. There could possibly be some way for like a kid like that to maybe have some regret and some redemption, but every incentive and every person around him seems to be saying, no, you actually did the right thing. Like,
Emma, don't you think
therapy? He needs to be in therapy.
Don't you think he would have rather have been shot than having done those shootings?
Mm.
That he goes out and when he's out there, you know, being feted by the conservative media, that it's the smiles of it's like the tears of a clown type of situation. Mm-hmm. He wishes he was on the other side of that somebody had shot him. As he was trying to protect the Piggly Wiggly or whatever it was down there. But instead, he has to deal with that trial, which lasted almost, what, like 3 weeks? My God.
Three weeks.
What kind of country is it where you cannot shoot two people dead and injure a third? And you have to spend, what, 2 or 3 weeks in a trial? He had to buy a suit. He had to buy a suit and wear a tie. My God. And now, like, he's going, he's having to go around to all these, I mean, it's hard.
You got to feel bad for the Covington Catholic kids, because is there anyone going to remember them now that Kyle's
right.
the new mayor?
That's right. That's right. They've lost countless Fox News opportunities now that Rittenhouse is here. He had to wear a suit. Let's go to some IMs. These will be the final IMs that I read. In 2021. See you next year. this is when my kids get, my Saul gets really excited about it. Saul actually is now singing what he thinks is a dirty song. It doesn't really seem like that sing-songy, but it is like the pineapple coconut, big carrot song.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, that's basically it. Pineapple, coconut, big carrot. Yeah, there you go.
What?
But the dream ain't mine. Sam, you banal waste of white male privilege. Seriously, did a witch put a curse on you where you age 5 times faster than everyone else? Hey, here's a riddle. What do you get when you take 2018 Sam Cedar, watch him get struck by lightning a couple of dozen times, then beat him silly with a toilet brush? That's right, 2021 Sam Cedar. As God is my witness, I don't know why Emma and the crew don't gouge you in those bleary urinal cakes you call eyes. Finally tell you to go fuck a duck so they can take over the show once and for all. Anyway, I love the show and just wanted to ask, is your right nut bigger than the other two? Well, that is not that you're going to have to wait for my People magazine profile to find that out. Nerd Cheetah, is that your voice I hear on the DirecTV ad? It sounds like you. What's his face? Health inspector voice, but more chesty version instead of nasal. It is. If it is mine, then they have stolen my voice because I have not been. I have not recorded anything for. I have not done a voiceover ad in. Oh, 10 years? I don't know. Left of the box, some good news. I got my passport today so I can travel to the live show. And since I needed to order a new birth certificate for it, I updated my gender. So now both my passport and birth certificate have my gender as X to reflect my non-binary status. Can we buy merch at the show? Yes, I haven't bought any because of the extra cost to ship it across the border. And I'd love to buy some there. I'll try to call in. The phone lines are open. Erica 519. Sorry, we're not going to do phones today. Chicken shit Cedar. Hey, MR crew, I'm booked to get my booster today during the show. Hope everyone else listening got it or plans to. Yes, folks, please get your booster. The data shows that with Omicron, I think it's around, at least this is the initial data out of South Africa and maybe Israel. Two shots, part of it might be the distance from the shot, the second shot, is only 30%. Now, part of that might be a function of, like, most people got that second shot, got it further out. So maybe if you just got your second shot, it might have better efficacy. But once you get your booster, you're back up around, like, 80, 90%, they say. Attorney Andrew. North Dakota Llama. There's an old video game that was called Omicron, the Nomad Soul that starred David Bowie. Yes, actually. And people are taking dialogue from the crappy video game and saying David Bowie tried to warn us. That's why they got him. Oy, oy, oy. Attorney Andrew. Hey, Sam, the people who I am saying Joe Biden and the Dems want to lose are dumb. Yet one thing this shows downplays is how captured the Dem leadership is by neoliberal ideology in ways that undermine the material implications of any agenda they may have. First, in their mind, there's only a small marginal political difference between saying you will do something and actually doing it. They also actively cultivate this dynamic because it means they never truly lose or fail. They were just stymied by this or that flavor this month. Second, they're convinced that the difference between saying and actually doing something is relatively small on a material level as well. They don't think that government is the primary mover of good things. They think government merely nudges or facilitates private actors. From that mindset, if they fail at actually doing something, at least they told the private sector where their priorities should be. In some, they aren't conniving. They're neoliberal nihilists. I think that's a fairly accurate assessment.
Joe Biden was lecturing black civil rights leaders about how interracial families in commercials is going to lead to progress in this country. Yeah, I mean, it's exactly right. That's why they can't do anything. They literally don't know how. It's not like the FDR thing where you have like a confrontation with Campbell that had been brewing since like the Teddy Roosevelt era. We just like these people are brainless in terms of actually confronting the problems we need them to confront.
Defense straight tour extraordinaire. With the delay, and I'm assuming the end of the reconciliation bill, what's the plan moving forward for Biden and the Dems in Congress? What is the game plan to not lose Congress when the Dems can't solve a two-person dissent? I mean, like I say, I don't think that passing Build Back Better, as of even last summer, was going to necessarily help them electorally. What was going to help them electorally was the sort of the subtext of that, which is they can get stuff done.
Yeah.
They're effective. It created momentum. It would create just a sort of like a sense that they're doing stuff. I don't know if that would have guaranteed anything anyways. I don't think there is a plan. I think the plan is they're going to push a lot of the January 6th stuff, which I think they should do. But I think this is going to undercut what they're doing because they didn't do the other thing. So now it looks like they're just doing this to cover up the fact that they failed at the other thing, as opposed to this is something you do when you've done the other thing. I think they're going to try and do the Voting Rights Act. They might get some voting bill passed. I tend to doubt it, but it's possible. Joe Manchin may see that as some way to sort of like make up for his destroying of Joe Biden's agenda. I don't know. Viva La and Majority Report. Crave Bot. I slang drugs growing up, and a lot of my market was neo-Nazis. A good portion of them hated all Abrahamic religions, and yet we're into a weird KKK evangelist version of Christianity. I don't really talk about this because of the AB. Interesting. He's Black Milo. That guy, Penny from New Mexico. Remailing COVID tests. My husband has Medicare, and BCBS sent him 2 free tests as a matter of practice. They just came in the mail unrequested. Oh, that's great. It's always snowy in Iowa. Did you guys make a custom ad for YouTube? As I was clicking the link, the ad was for something called Intellectual Dark Wave, and there was a jingle that ended with the line, poo-pooing cheese and crackers with Sam Cedar. No. Is that true? No. That's got to be a joke. Amos. Sam, you must be proud. You discovered Brandon Straka, and now he's singing like a canary to the feds in the January 6th committee. Is that true?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, we got... let's do 10 more here. It's already 3 o'clock. Project Un-F the World. What up, MR crew? I'm really starting to understand this moment. The school shooting already being out of the news cycle, the Democrats' political nothing burgers, and how now we have teachers participating in Hunger Games. Aims, this project is getting harder all the time, but the fight goes on. David Drizzle 8585 from Twitch chat should call in. Okay. Sam Cedar, extenuating circumstances of silliness. Sam, now that you're single, vaccinated, and you won't face any punishment for murdering all those people, what kind of woman are you looking for? What?
That was Stephen Crowder talking to Kyle Rittenhouse about...
Oh, yeah. Jesus. Elon's pungent Musk. How is the show not touched on Abby Shapiro's tweet about throat goat Nancy Reagan?
Oh, I mean,
I haven't heard. It's a little bit of a Twitter thing, but
yeah, it's, I don't want to.
Prairie Fire Kowalski. Hey, Sam, am I on crew? Hey, Sam, as I understand it, it's the last live show of the year for you. 2021 has been a rolling dumpster fire. I would agree. Like 2020, creating much anxiety and general state of hopelessness for many. Not me, of course. I'm a stoic farmer that knows things could always get worse. Anywho, your show and crew have been a solid rock, creating a community that has helped many, not just weather the proverbial and literal storms, but add to our confidence and understanding of politics, labor, and virology. I have no doubt this program has saved lives by making viewers demand relatives, friends, and coworkers get vaccinated. Can't be measured by statistically had to happen. Very excited for the big live. I'm coming up with some friends I don't see often and are huge Boston sports fans. 2021 will go down in history as the year Cold Feet Crowder was given a stroke by the mere presence of Sam. Have a merry, very merry holidays, left his best. I'm so excited. And thank you for the very kind note. I'm so excited to see people at this show. I can't even tell you. One thing I experienced when I went to my first yearly Co's, the first one ever, which ultimately became Netroots Nation. I used to take IMs on my old on our show at in between breaks. Or no, it was IMs and also blog posts. And I would see people and meet them, and I would immediately see their avatar or their name on an IM screen. It was such a bizarre feeling. And it's so weird to like have such an attachment to, you know, things like Judy Giuliani and see that person and they, you know, say, hi, I'm, you know, Mary. And it's like, no, I just see Judy Giuliani in front of you. But yes, very much looking forward. Judy Giuliani, they stopped playing live because the amplification tech at the time wasn't good enough for them to hear themselves on stage while screaming at their shows. On stage monitoring wasn't loud enough. Interesting. That's referring to the Beatles. Kirby 424, hey guys, can I get a shofar? I just hit a major milestone in my thesis research on desalination membrane materials just in time for Christmas. I don't know what that means, but great. Sounds important. All right, five more. Jay Tingle, Billy Preston is the only musician to get a credit on a Beatles credit. I mean, it must mean album. Ray, Kristen Walker is a student at UCLA. Rob from Dedham. We need a 21st century Ralph Nader to help put pressure on these companies like Tesla and Uber on crypto and other DeFi things. Reactionary regulating by default makes way too many concessions to these unregulated tech companies. Robbie Sulls, I work in public health. Only 10% of people are boosted. Without a boost, people have only 20% protection from Omicron. I've heard it's closer to 30, but who knows? With a boost, they have 90% protection. I've heard closer to like 85, but okay. Especially with the holiday gatherings, people should plan on getting boosted ASAP if they can. Most people are eligible now. It's true. And, you know, the booster, I think, you know, you got to be 2 weeks out until you probably get the most benefit from it, but you're getting benefit as it goes up. It is not like a binary thing. It's not like you get 14 days out and all of a sudden it's 90% protection. It moves up the sort of steps up the ladder. Go get your booster right now, folks. Is this me? I love that the leader of an obviously AstroTurf women's group defending Christianity is a pagan winter festival celebration is a man. Didn't the Bush regime have conference on women's rights totally made up of white men? 1,500 at least gun Kyle used to murder two people. He's struggling. White communist? Rittenhouse didn't go to Kenosha to protect property. That is a cover story. Armed white paramilitaries appeared at Ferguson in 2014 and nationwide at BLM protests in 2020 to oppose justice for African Americans. Where were Rittenhouse and other fascists when state capitals were being vandalized or church property burned in D.C.? The fascists were the ones smashing and burning. Protecting property is a euphemism for threatening African Americans and their supporters in old white supremacist project. That sounds like a pretty reasonable assumption. To me. All right, two more. Creepy Cruise 69. I live in daily terror of Christmas's nuclear weapons. And the final I am probably of 2021 for me. I get sentimental. I look like so askance.
It's 306.
I know.
Okay.
Skippy. Thanks for the laugh, Sam. Hope you enjoy your time off. Matt, Bradley, Emma, great job in 2021, guys. You still got a little more to go, but yeah, I'm assuming that
we're doing stuff after this. That's why I'm
being... Oh, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
See you in the new year. Emma will be here Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and